What's up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricky Brandes. Today, we have Richard Grove. If you think it's been too long since my last podcast, well, hopefully I didn't disappoint with this four-hour conversation I had with Richard Grove. Amazing conversation. I'm a huge fan of his website, Tragedy and Hope, of his documentary, State of Mind. I'm going to keep this intro short because obviously it's a four-hour podcast, so why the hell would I waste your time with this intro? But if you guys aren't familiar with him, check out his website, tragedyandhope.com. His podcast is called The Peace Revolution Podcast. You can find that on iTunes or anywhere you can find podcasts. Obviously, if you're listening to this, you probably know where you can get podcasts. And you can also find him on Tragedy and Hope on Facebook and him on Twitter and all that stuff. And of course, if you go on our YouTube channel, you can look in the show notes or the show descriptions, and you can find links to my guest's website and their Twitter account and Facebook and all that stuff. So it makes it easy to look more into their work if you're interested in them. But super smart guy. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of his work and huge fan of his. Anytime he's doing an interview or has a new video on his YouTube channel, which is called Tragedy and Hope Mag, which can be a little confusing, but I think I heard him in a previous interview talk about how Tragedy and Hope was right taken. So if you find a YouTube channel called Tragedy and Hope Mag, that's his. So always putting up new interviews and videos on there. And like I always say, this podcast is so much fun, and I've done so much growing throughout this whole adventure and this whole journey. And I'm sure my listeners hopefully have done some growing too, by just being exposed to new perspectives and ideas. But this podcast, I feel like I was growing during the podcast. I feel like I just did 10 podcasts with 10 really smart people and had a life-changing transitional event occur. But nonetheless, it was fun. Anytime I talk to somebody for this long, it's cool, because even though I don't actually know these people personally, you definitely seem to get a good idea of who they are and what type of person they are, and a good judge of character, and it's hard to bullshit for this long. I think there's a lot of truth to the fact that if you sit down and have a conversation with somebody long enough, it's hard to not see through who they are and the type of person they are. And the one thing I love is that I get to meet all these really cool people, incredibly smart people who have really interesting ideas, and hopefully a lot of these people are much more popular than I am. You know, their shows and their work is much more popular than mine. But if I can expose their ideas or their perspectives to some people who might not be familiar with it, you know, I've done my job. And also, if I can just bring you a different type of conversation, because, you know, one thing I laughed about on the show, and it's kind of funny because it's not on purpose, but in a way it's not really avoided, is the fact that a lot of times what the guest is known for, sometimes we get completely off track and we don't talk about those topics or those subjects. But I think that's one of the great things about the show. You can hear Richard Grove's interviews that he's done in the past, and he's done a lot of them about his 9/11 experience, which is really interesting. So please, you know, if you don't think that you got enough of that in this show, look up other interviews, and, you know, like he's done with James Corbett, or he's done on Breaking the Set with Abby Martins, or any other interviews you can find where he talks about his 9/11 whistleblowing and his whole experience with that. But hopefully, if you're familiar with his work and you've seen those type of interviews a bunch of times, you get a whole different perspective on my show. You'll get the perspective, or a whole different conversation, I should say. We go down roads that he hasn't gone down on other shows, and we both got to just share ideas and life experiences and personal opinions and stuff like that. And just really interesting conversation. So I said I was going to keep this short. I'm probably going down the road of going on a couple rants and not keeping it short. So I'm going to catch myself now and shut the hell up. And just let you guys know, subscribe to our YouTube channel, RV Theory 6, or just look up the Ripple Effect Podcast. You'll find, and you'll find all the our episodes on there. Anytime somebody calls in using video on Skype, you'll see a video version of our episodes. Also, when you subscribe to us, wherever you subscribe to this podcast, if it's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever, please rate the show. It seems to help people find the show, and the percentage of listeners compared to the percentage of people who rate the show is it's very low. So hopefully, if you can just take a little bit of time out of your day to just rate the show, it'd be very much appreciated. Whatever you think we deserve, if it's 3 stars, 4 stars, 5 stars. You like how I started at 3 stars? Because even at my worst show, I think I at least deserve 3 stars. But obviously, whatever it is, you know, let it be. But just rate the show. You know, negative or positive feedback is always appreciated. And I hope I don't regret saying that. And that's it. And also remember, 36 Music Project is my music, where you can find that on my YouTube channel also, and you can find on Google Play, iTunes, anywhere you can find digital downloads, and it's a great way of supporting the show. And also, I start a Patreon page, which if anybody wants to be the first to start supporting the show monthly, it also be very much appreciated. Obviously, it's a holiday season. The economy's not that great. Money's tight, I'm sure. So, you know, no hard feelings if you can't support the show at this moment. If hopefully, eventually, you're in a good situation and you can. So, Richard Grove, filmmaker, writer, researcher, forensic historian, all around awesome dude, and obviously intellectual. If after this show, you'll pick up on that. And that's it. I'll see you on the next one. Peace.
Hello.
Hey, Ricky, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. Hey, Richard, how are you?
I'm good, man. Good afternoon.
Thanks. Thanks for being with me. Yeah, we're on the same time schedule, so that's always nice.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're only like 45 minutes away from here blew my mind. I thought the whole time I was listening, I was like, oh, this guy probably lives on the other, you know, the left coast and somewhere out in California.
Yeah, it's funny because it seems like a lot of podcasters are, you know, in the West Coast. I don't know. You figured in the East Coast, because we're much crazier lifestyles. You know, we're always on the go and on the run, and everybody works 100 hours a week. Podcasts would be perfect for commuting or, you know, while you're on the train or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it seems like at least people who create podcasts, it's a lot of people in the West Coast and California, and you know, it's weird. Yeah, I haven't had too many people on the show that are actually from the East Coast. I know James Perloff is from Boston.
Really? He's in Boston? See, I figured he was someplace like Wisconsin or Chicago, Illinois, or someplace yeah. like that. He's in Boston?
Yeah. He's I think either Boston or some suburb right outside of Boston. But it's funny because one thing it'd be awesome to do is every once in a while I'm like, you know, if I could find somebody. And actually, CJ Hunt, you ever see the documentary The Perfect Human Diet?
No.
It's really good. It's really good. Yeah, and he's actually just, I think he's just moved to Connecticut too, and he's supposed to be on, I think, for February, because he thinks that's when he'll be settled in and ready to come on. But yeah, he lives in Connecticut. And same thing, I always want to meet people in person, because I think it's one thing that I'm kind of jealous of some of the podcasts who have a lot of people in studio, is that you get to connect differently in person. You know, even though Skype is a great way of connecting from a distance, there's something missing, you know, from Skype when you're not actually there. And the few times I've had people guests on the show in person in studio, it's so much easier to flow through a conversation, to know when to jump in and not jump in, because that's the other thing that you have to work on when you're doing Skype. It's sometimes there's a delay, so it's like you start talking but they weren't done talking, and there's a lot of things that I feel like you kind of lose through Skype. So a lot of times I'm like, you know what, if somebody lives nearby, I'm like, I don't mind, you know, hanging out and, you know, meeting some of these people. I'm like, really, if I think you're cool enough to have on the show, I'm like, you're probably cool enough to hang out with. So and you, like myself, are into cigars, and I'm always looking for reasons to light one up and hang out. And even when I started smoking, that was the big thing, was it was just a reason to sit down and have a conversation, because like a lot of people, generations, you know, younger than us, they're going to lose out on that. You know, they're kind of so overstimulated by technology and lights and things constantly telling them that they have a notification, that I think that they kind of miss out on smells and tastes and aromas and the simple things that I think are actually getting a little more popular, because I think we're getting so detached from that.
Well, I think that when you're sitting around with some friends and you're all, you know, partaking of a cigar, which is a rarer thing today than I think probably any time in the past, because it's prohibited in so many places. Like, I don't even think Hartford has like a cigar bar where you could go and enjoy a cigar without feeling like you're an outcast and have to stand out in the street or something. So it usually takes place around, you know, campfires or doing, you know, some sort of task associated with preparing for winter. And it's like you're outside, so you have the opportunity to have a cigar. And what I notice is people use their cell phone a lot less. They actually look you in the eye. They're actually having conversations and stimulating their own thoughts by listening to you. And it's something I think that's, you know, lost in the online culture. And, you know, that was a great episode, by the way, that you did, you know, on the cigars as a topic. And one of the things you pointed out is you don't see people like, you know, standing outside, shivering outside the revolving door of their office building, trying to squeeze in a cigar. You know, the whole urge mentality that comes with cigarettes, that cigar smoking is something that you do to relax and it's pleasurable, but it's not necessarily like you don't have to do it at that time. You still have your own volition involved in it, you know? And so it's not something that's as easily addicting as cigarettes. And because you're only having a couple cigars a month or whatever, that's not necessarily something that's going to adversely affect your health. But those conversations, if you get together with your friends who also like to partake, you come up with new ideas and you have new perspectives, and it's like a refreshment that you get to have a couple times a month and use it for your own benefit as opposed to like smoking cigarettes.
Oh, absolutely. I had C.J. Worldman on the show. I don't know if you know who he is. He's one of those popular atheists. He's written quite a few books on religion and stuff like that. But he's a really cool guy, and he's from Australia. And it's funny because he's an atheist, but yet he's always butting heads with the new atheists, you know, the Dawkins and the Harris and stuff like that. So I give him a lot of credit because it's like the people who, you know, he could jump on board and try to win their fans over to sell more books. He's pretty outspoken about. But he talked about how the big difference in Australian and American culture is pub culture. This idea that like in Australia, people hang out, they have drinks, and it's their time to kind of share ideas and what's going on in your lives and stuff like that. And it seems like in America, it's kind of true, because in America, it's like you go to a bar, you're going to watch a game, or you're going to, if you're single, you're going to meet people, or, you know, or you're going to check out girls or whatever. And or there's loud music and you're not really talking. And there is like this disconnect. And it's crazy because when you look at the history of America, you know, pub culture was so important. I mean, obviously, you know, anybody who has European ancestors, alcohol was a huge part of you know, of the civilization and the culture, and people would hang out at the pubs and argue and have discussions and you know, our founding fathers drank and, you know, were moonshiners and stuff like that. And so it's really interesting how, you know, we've kind of lost that. And I think the nice thing about cigars is that you don't enjoy a cigar at a loud place. You enjoy cigars at a quiet place, and you sit around. And there's something like, even my co-host who's on the show once in a while, the guy who I started the show with, Dave, he doesn't even smoke cigars, but he'll be hanging out and hang out when the rest of us are smoking sometimes. And he's like, it's funny, man. Because I told him, I'm like, there's something about cigars that it brings out the best conversations. And he one of the times we're hanging out, he's like, Rick, you're right, man. He's like, it seems like we always get in the deepest conversations when people are smoking cigars. And I think a lot of it does have to do with the fact that it's maybe it's a little bit the tobacco. I mean, there's a lot of people who smoke cigarettes, and I know journalists back in the day, everybody used to have a cigarette hanging out their mouths, and a lot of people used to write and smoke. And but I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that to enjoy a cigar, you're enjoying smells and tastes, so you're kind of slowing down. It forces you to slow down a little bit, and that's why I like wine too. It's the same thing. You can't really drink wine fast. It forces you to slow down and kind of just think, you know, gather your thoughts, think a little bit, or even if you're not thinking, you're just meditating, and for lack of a better term, you're meditating because you're just kind of, you know, forgetting everything and just kind of relaxing and releasing. And I think sometimes we need that. I think that's why I've said this on the show. I think that's why yoga's gotten popular. I think yoga's gotten popular because some, you know, besides the stretching and the workout part of it, I think people like the fact that you're focused on one thing or you're focused on nothing, however you handle it. And you kind of get your time away from the stresses of everyday life, from the fast pace, you know, culture and life we've created, where it's all about, you know, buying things to try to make us happy because we hate our lives. And then, you know, satisfaction is a death of desire. So once that thing kind of doesn't satisfy you anymore, you move on to the next thing, and then you got to make more money, so you're constantly trying to get promoted to buy these material things that make you happy. And it's this conscious cycle. And then I think that, you know, the nice thing about cigars or anything, you know, not just to give all the credit to cigars, but anything like that can kind of force you to slow down and stop and think about things and reflect, it really puts things in perspective. And you don't realize how little of the day you actually spend doing that until every once in a while you do that and you sit around, have a cigar, and then you realize, holy shit, that was a really good conversation. And you realize how rare that it is to actually have those type of conversations. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure in that rant there was some point that I was trying to make. But what's your thoughts? You tend to agree with that?
Well, that's a lot to tend to agree with. But if I broke it down into individual parts, I think most of those individual parts would agree. Like, to define thinking, I would say thinking is to not meditate on purpose. And then meditating is not to think on purpose. And that's like, the two gears you go through in human interaction and figuring things out for yourself. Your comments earlier about being in studio, being a lot more lively than just over a Skype connection, that's absolutely true. And, you're welcome to come down and do one of my episodes. I do a show called The Deep End, and we have a couple people live in studio. We usually have a couple people on Skype, and that kind of bridges the gap. So, since you're a podcaster and you live on the East Coast and you're actually within a couple hours driving distance, you'd be one of the few podcasters on the East Coast that I know, and I'd be happy to have you in studio. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And that leads into the next step, which is someday I hope to have a studio where we could actually have cigars on the show. But since it's in my basement.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing, too.
We could have them in the garage. Maybe we can move the setup into the garage and we can do an episode from out there.
Well, the casino, when I go down to the casino, that's the nice thing about the casino is that, you can smoke there in certain spots and they have a cigar lounge.
So
and
like
stuff.
Mohegan?
Yeah, Mohegan.
Foxwoods, those are the ones here in Connecticut. So I haven't been to those. So they still let you smoke in the casinos?
Yeah, well, they have non-smoking areas. So they'll have certain parts that will be non-smoking. But the majority of the casino, you can smoke. And there's also a cigar lounge in Mohegan. Mohegan's the one that, I don't know, me and my wife just favor that one because that's just the one we go to the most. And then we just end up getting familiar with it. So we go there more often than Foxwoods. But they have a cigar lounge, which is awesome because you sit down, you can pick your cigar. And it's funny, me and my buddy owns a cigar shop in the town that I live in Ludlow. And he's been getting harassed by the town about selling flavored cigars or trying to ban flavored cigars or trying to ban, vapors and all this stuff, which is just ridiculous. It's just, when has making something illegal or harder to get through a store make it disappear? It doesn't. I mean, we have a heroin epidemic, a pill epidemic, all these things get, people get them even if they're, they're illegal. And, one thing we've talked about was opening a cigar lounge because, it's one of those things where, we both smoke and he's Lebanese. So smoking is a big part of his culture, hookah and stuff like that. And I love smoking. So we're talking about how, in the East Coast, we need more cigar lounges because it'd be a perfect place to open one up because we're constantly in, it's constantly cold. So, our summers are so short. So you only really get to smoke, half of the year, if that. And or maybe a quarter of the year, and then the rest of the year, you're kind of just looking for a nice day, here and there where you can actually light one up. But it's we need more cigar lounges where you can actually smoke inside and stuff like that. But like you were saying, even at the casino, unless I'm at the cigar lounge or I'm somewhere where I'm not bothering anybody, it's hard for me to enjoy a cigar when I feel like it's going in the direction of people who aren't smoking. I'm always like, oh, I don't want to be that dickhead who.
Well, it's just common courtesy, and even if you're in a cigar lounge, you don't want your smoke blowing somebody's face like that, So that's not
cool.
So that's just common courtesy, and you're concerned about other people's. Feelings, well-being, being comfortable around you, this whole sort of thing while you're trying to, partake of a little tobacco. I mean, it's something that's been in culture in Western world for a couple hundred years and other cultures for thousands of years. And I think that what you're talking about, because I come from, first off, I haven't probably been in the casino since Vegas like 15 years ago. So I'm not. Yeah, that's why I asked. I'm like, oh, they still let you smoke in casinos and stuff like that. But I remember when I was living in New York when they were just basically, oh, you can't smoke in restaurants or you can't do this outside, outside of restaurants within certain number of feet or, there's all these new rules going up around it. And I understand, if you're not a smoker, you don't want to smell that. That's fine. But, your freedom does have limitations and it shouldn't, if you're not present, then it doesn't concern you, right?
Yeah.
So there's this whole, so when places, so that just gets to the generality of prohibitions. And your point was prohibiting it doesn't stop it from being wanted or having, you know, cause and effect in the market. That just goes on now in the black market area, and it's off people's radars. Prohibition, you know, traditionally in the last 100 years have led to gangsters and organized crime being in control of those industries and then having the leverage to, corrupt justice and politics. And that's why you kind of have the situation we have today. It's like the intelligence agencies merged with organized crime a long time ago. So you're going to have a lot of these prohibitions. And so from my position, these prohibitions are a philosophical argument. You know, when you tell me I can't do something, that when I'm doing something, it's not infringing on your freedom. That type of prohibition is basically an argument that you're saying that you're my master, I'm your slave. And if that's your argument, I'd just like to see the proof of the argument, you know. So how did I come to be under, you know, under you as you being my master? And you can tell me if, you know, if you're at a restaurant in New York City and you're sitting outside and your friends are all eating at that restaurant, but you want pizza and you go next door and get a slice of pizza and come back and sit down, and someone says, hey, you can't do that. Well, that's an argument that, you know, you're under them as a slave. They're going to determine what you do and what, you know, what is right or wrong or whatever. So you're going to run into these types of prohibitions all over the place. I think that cigarette smokers are the most highly aware of that. And cigar smokers would be the next, because it's not that you can't do it in certain places. It's just that now it's just like frowned upon to use any sort of tobacco for, especially, the mentality of it. You know, it's just going to get more people to do stimulus and reaction without thinking between that stimulus and reaction. You know,
I completely agree. And I think that it just, it's, where does it end? You know, it's like when you're talking about New York, you know, like the ridiculous law of you can't buy whatever size soda it was that they were trying to ban. It's like, what does that do? I mean, all you do is, you know, you restrict that size soda, people will just buy two smaller ones. It's like, it's more laws over more. So it's like, okay, well, if that doesn't work, now we have to create another law and then another law. And like you said, like, everybody has the right to pursue happiness. And as long as you're not getting in the way of somebody else's right to pursue happiness, then I don't give a shit what you do. You know, it's like, enjoy your life. You know, our lives are too short. You know, if you're lucky, you make it to 80 or 90 at a decent health where you can actually enjoy life. And, you know, you're here on a limited, you know, time, and to have all these restrictions on what makes you happy, or people to dictate how you can find or what you can do for happiness or how you should live your life or whatever, it's just ridiculous. It's so insane. You know, people should have the right to do what they like as long as they're not harming anybody else. And I think if everybody just came to agreement on that, we'd be much happier, you know. And prohibition, I mean, obviously that didn't work. I mean, don't get me wrong, at that time, America was having a serious drinking problem and stuff like that. But obviously, you know, it's how much of it had to do with people who were overworked or were unhappy for other reasons. You know, there's a great argument about, you know, this idea of what is addiction and what causes addiction. Is it the substance itself, or is it some other internal issue? You know, you look at Dr. Carl Hart, you know, who makes the argument that it's not the substance so much itself, it's the person. And I tend to think that there's a lot of truth to that. You know, it's like that study with the mice. I don't know if they put cocaine or whatever it was in the water, and they put in the water just, and they had some water that didn't have any substance and the water that did have the substance, and the mouse kept coming back to that water. So it's like, oh, we proved that it's addictive. And then they decide, you know what, this cage has become a part of this experiment. So let's create this giant facility where it has places to roam and play, and then it has other mice to play with and mate with and all this stuff, and see if the same thing happens. And then the mouse didn't come back. So it was one of those things where it wasn't the substance that was addictive that was making the mouse come back, but it was depression or unhappiness of being in that cage that, you know, and isn't that what life's about? Life's about, I mean, we smoke things that make us happy. Enjoy company because it makes us happy. We listen to podcasts or music or documentaries or films or whatever that make us happy. So if you don't have happiness in your life and that substance is giving you a little bit of happiness, I think it's human nature to go back to it, you know? So maybe it's more of a searching for happiness, searching for purpose than the substance itself.
Well, I think also if you're missing times of reflection that, you know, doing something social like that, even if it's having a cocktail, and I distinguish that against like binge drinking or just doing shots all night. It's like having a cocktail and a cigar is one type of social interaction, and then the other social interaction you can't cognitively participate because you've basically numbed yourself beyond recognition to that situation. So that's where, you know, it did have a place because it allowed people to reflect and to think creatively and to be inventive, think about their problems, and they invent new solutions. So with this coming out of our society, like, you've noticed its absence in society. That was the first thing we talked about when we got on the show, was you're talking about, you know, pubs and the pub culture around the world, whereas in America, you're going out and it's an agenda. You want to watch the game, and you're going to go to a sports bar that has like 100 TV screens, or your agenda is the hookup, so you're going to go out and go to a place that facilitates that. Those predetermined agendas are the opposite of the traditional public house. This is where the idea of a pub comes from. There used to be public houses. And basically, that's a no-agenda place where things are open to discussion, where you could have an eventual agenda that we all agree that we need freedom, and then it starts to inspire and transpire that in those premises. That's the origins of the Boston Tea Party. You're not going to see that today at, you know, Hooters or, you know, some of these other sports bars that are out there that are catered toward very non-intellectual, very non-freedom-oriented tasks. And it's like, I remember when I lived in New York, one of my favorite places that you could have a cocktail and a cigar was a place that was like an old library. And so there's an intellectual atmosphere and discussion of things that people have learned, and that exchange of knowledge is innately valuable because, you know, back in yesteryear, just talking about where we're coming from in history, you only learn so much through cause and effect on a farm. But if you go into the town and you go to the public house and somebody just read this new book or wrote this new book and published it, and there's the discussion and heated debate around these things, that changes everybody. That participation in that conversation, or even just listening to it, changes things, as opposed to watching what I would call disposable media, which is anything that you're not going to go back and watch after you know the conclusion. Oh, you watched that football game? You're probably not going to go back and watch it because there's another new game coming up and all this new stuff coming at you. So, something that you would go back and revisit is something that you learned a great deal from, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And you say, hey, there's still more I could absorb from that, so I'm going to go and listen to it or watch it again.
Yeah, I mean, we've all watched documentaries. I mean, yours, the one that you wrote, State of Mind, by Free Mind Films. I've had Chris Emery on and some people from the Free Mind Films on the show a few times. But that's a great film, and there's so much information on there in that film that I've watched it quite a few times. Actually, I think I just started watching it again last night, just to kind of, because it's just hard to consume all the information, but that's what makes it fun. It's just, you know, every time I watch it, there's like some piece of information I forgot about that was really interesting. And I'm sure you cut it down, you know, you probably had, you know, 1,000 hours of information that you guys had to cut out of it. But it was just really interesting. And I, you know, that type of stuff is awesome. And in Massachusetts, at one time, it was against the law not to have a pub in every town. And usually they were near churches because churches didn't have heat. So after church, people would go to the pub and have some drinks. And like you said, they would argue about things. I mean, who knows? The Constitution was probably argued at a pub, you know, parts of the Constitution or parts of whatever.
There was,
you know,
probably tobacco involved. It might have been a pipe. But, you know, it's just something that it is known to stimulate thought. And they took something that was good and they, you know, for commercial mass market use, you know, the average cigarette, I don't know how many hundreds of chemicals, but there's been a number of lawsuits that have shown that they'll put everything in there but tobacco to make you more hooked. Because if you just smoked tobacco, and I think cigars are good proof of this, because they don't have those extra hundreds of chemicals added, they're not nearly as addictive, and you actually get stuff done in between them instead of waiting for the next one. That's the difference, in my opinion, between cigarettes and cigars.
I know it's hard to not sound biased because we're cigar smokers, but I tell people all the time, I'm like, there has to be something. It's no different than, like, I compare it to eating at McDonald's, you know, a hamburger, or eating a hamburger at with grass-fed, you know, meat. You know, it's different. Yeah, they're both beef. They both seem the same. But one is much better for you. And if you eat one every day, it won't be so bad for you than if you eat the other one every day. And I feel like cigarettes and cigars are the same thing. Like, there's a reason why I have to put my cigars in a humidor and I have to keep the humidity up, because it has to be in the climate where it was grown and where, you know, where it's from. And because it goes bad. I mean, you buy a pack of cigarettes, it's not in a humidor, and you can just throw it in your car, and you can smoke them now, you can smoke them, you know, in a couple of days, and for the most part, it tastes the same. I'm like, there's a reason for that, because there's all those additives, and I wonder how much of, you know, all this epidemic of cancer, lung cancer, all this stuff of cigarettes, how much of it had to do with the additives that they're adding to it, and not so much just the pure tobacco. I mean, and you're obviously inhaling where cigars, you don't inhale quite as much, but I don't know too many people, if anybody, who died of directly because of cigar smoke. And I mean, Delicia, who the show you were referring to, Delicia Silva, the cigar reviewer, she made a statement. I'm not sure if she's correct, but she is pretty outspoken about the fact that she doesn't think cigars are bad for you. If you know, in moderation, of course. And I think there's probably some truth to that. I mean, there's a study that I shared on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, maybe both, that, they came to conclusion that one cigar a day didn't have any increase in all these health risks compared to the average person. And maybe that study's a little biased too, but you know what? I'm not sure there's been, and I think even in the study, they talked about how there's not enough research into the direct effect of cigars, of people who only smoke cigars compared to people who don't smoke cigars. And so I don't think there's been enough research. I think people assume that anytime you're inhaling smoke, it must be the same as cigarettes. But we know with marijuana, that's not the same thing. I mean, people smoke weed, and it doesn't have the same, you know, cancerous effects on your body as smoking cigarettes. So even though you are inhaling smoke, I mean, it's not all the same. You know, not all smoke is equal. So it's really interesting, because it's one of those things where, you know, I always say, you know, I'm like, cigars aren't a healthy alternative than cigarettes, but it's just I believe it's a healthier alternative. You know, it's not quite as bad if it is bad for you. So, and I think, you know, like I tell my wife, I'm like, you know, because we have kids, I have a 2-year-old or turning 2 in February, and I have a 3-month-old or turning 4 months tomorrow, actually. And but it's one of those things where I tell her, I'm like, the mental release and therapy it mentally gives me smoking a cigar and having some bourbon or whiskey, whatever I'm drinking, it's much more beneficial compared to maybe the negative effects of actually smoking, you know, the cigar. I think that, you know, we kind of take for granted mental health and that, you know, just being able to kind of reflect and gather your thoughts and maybe re-examine, did I overreact on that decision, or was I angry when I shouldn't have been, or how could I handle that differently? You know, I think all those things are just really important, because I think we can get caught up in just being machines, and you know, we're very we get into habits, and we wake up every day and we do the same thing, and we don't ever stop and think about things. And that's another thing I like about having a cocktail and having a drink or having a smoke, is that because you're putting a substance that kind of changes your perspective a little bit, and you do a lot of traveling. One thing I liked about, you know, I'm a person that I love being at home, but one thing I love about traveling is it kind of gets you out of your routine, and then you start thinking about things differently, because you're taking in different things, you know, so your input affects your output. And so I think same thing with, you know, maybe having a smoke or having a drink, it changes the way you think a little bit. So you might pick up on something that you might not necessarily have examined if you weren't having a smoke and a drink. But that's just my experience with it.
Well, I think that what's lost in the situation. And so I think there's the flexibility of human beings. Like, we have tensegrity. You have this strength, but you also have this elasticity to a certain point that preserves the integrity. I think tensegrity was a term coined by Buckminster Fuller, but the application of the term is universal, because you can find it in things. Well, it's a characteristic. So it either has tensegrity or it doesn't. So what you're getting is, you know, let's say somebody who's listening smokes cigarettes and they smoke a pack or a couple packs a day. Well, if you're not in the right mental attitude, trying to quit is actually worse than smoking is, because you're talking about health. So is it just the physical stress caused by taking in this tobacco with all these chemical additives, or is that stress greater or equal to the mental stress and anxiety that sets in from trying to, you know, get away from that at a time when you're not mentally, like, ready to do it? And I mean tensegrity. Not going to, you know, have a nicotine fit if you don't have a smoke every couple minutes or couple hours or whatever, right? So you have to kind of, you know, recognize that it's different for all individuals, I think there's a lot of money made in a market where they try to help people quit smoking by giving you other chemicals. And the people who make those methods are either aware or not aware that, you know, it's more of a mental crutch than a physical crutch. And even though you're used to taking all these chemicals in, it really, you know, the chances of your success are determined by your mentality, not, you know, Nicorette or CQ patch or whatever all those other products are that kind of just wean people from one set of chemicals to the other. Because tobacco itself, I don't think has the same gravity to it, which is why those chemical companies called cigarette companies have added they've experimented on so much, and so much of that science has been defined over decades and decades that they're working people like products instead of customers. And the more chemicals that are in those type of cigarettes, you're going to have people increasing their usage, which increases whatever diseases are being caused by those chemicals. So again, going back to your original point, I don't think it's necessarily the tobacco that causes the problems within the human body. I think it's the foreign agents that your body can't process that slowly accumulate over time. But again, just knowing that might cause stress. So don't feel bad if you just heard that and now you need to go have a cigarette, because you'll figure your way out of it. But everyone's going to figure their way out of it if they're going to figure their way out of it in a unique path. And so, yes, you know, use the Nicorette or the CQ patch or whatever, but you, that's not the permanent solution. That should be one of the steps you take to get to that goal.
Yeah, well, they want you off, you know, other drugs, and they want you on their drugs. You know, it's just, you see it with pills. You know, you go to rehab, and then they get you on their, you know, their form of heroin or cocaine or,
well,
you know,
their methadone was. It was the Rockefeller's own synthetic heroin. And so back in the day when they, you know, and then they made the Rockefeller drug laws on top of that. So it's like they come up with a product and they make a funnel to jam all the people down into something that's going to make more money for them. And I even had a note from earlier when you were talking about the rats and the test, right? So you're talking about that story, and I remember learning about, they had this like a big like artificial city for rats down in Maryland, and it was sponsored by the Rockefellers back in like the 20s and 30s. They started doing tests on mice and rats, and they discovered they wanted to actually make something that was several acres to start to study them. And it's not because those groups and those nonprofit foundations were interested in rats or mice so much as they're interested in controlling human beings. That's the type of population control that they're interested in. Now, eugenics and these other things, sterilizing people, all those sorts of ideas that came along, that's part of the same philosophical argument that robber baron class has wielded against the, you know, the average people who don't even think about such things for the last couple hundred years. So it gets back to this idea of prohibitions and making a philosophical argument when you tell me what pronouns I have to use, well, then you're saying I'm your slave then, right? Just so we're clear. I have to listen to you, and I don't get to think for myself. That's the, you know, or even this thing that Obama just passed on Christmas Eve, the updated National Defense Authorization Act that says the FCC is going to control media on the Internet. And so they'll determine what's fake news or who has the right to publish and these sorts of things. And free speech and free press have been foundational ideas and elements of any type of constitutional republic. So
yeah, that whole thing.
We need more public house. We need more cocktails and cigars.
Oh,
and I think that's how we revive freedom. That's my theory for today.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think just the idea of people sharing ideas and thoughts, and I think I have a huge issue with, you know, especially with the holidays, you know, Christmas just went by and we have New Year's coming up. I have a huge issue with this idea of, oh, you never bring up religion or politics. Like, that bothers me, because the things that are the most important in our lives, you know, when you talk about politics and you know, just understanding how the world works and who's making the decisions and how it affects, you know, where our money's going and all that stuff. Like, we can't talk about that, but we can argue all day about sports. You know, we can all argue all day about the Giants and the Patriots or the Celtics and whoever. You know, it's like we can argue all day about that, and that's okay. Nobody ever says don't ever bring up sports. You know, it's like, no, we all gather around the TV and watch it.
You're allowed to argue about sports.
Yeah, that's my point. You know, so we can argue.
The best. No, your team's the best.
And people get in real heated arguments over this stuff. I know my brother's I like sports. I like the fact that, you know, after a stressful day, you know, I can put on the Celtics game or whatever, and for, you know, a couple hours, it gets me away from, you know, from everyday life, and, you know, I'm watching some really amazing athletes. And of course, you know, I know there's some fuckery with games and stuff like that. I had Brian Tui, I think, what was his last name? Tui, but he wrote The Fix Is In and
yeah,
a bunch
of... Yeah, I heard that one.
Yeah. And, you know, so I know that...
You don't have any illusions. You just know that, you know, back 100 years ago, you might have been having a cigar and a book, and now you can just watch the TV and your participation is barely needed. You just kind of have to keep your eyes open. Right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the bread and circus mentality. This sort of trend happened at the end of Rome. People stopped improving themselves and thinking about themselves in the long term as far as what is the legacy you're leaving behind for your family and your friends and anyone else who might have ever known you or heard of you. Today it's like, oh, let me just do something disposable with my time because I got too much of it and I can afford to waste it. And I've been through that mentality. I used to spend a lot of time watching sports, especially when I played sports. So I would watch baseball, football, ice hockey, because I played those sports. And for a couple years after I stopped playing those sports, I still watched it. And then I learned, oh, there's a lot more I have to take in as far as knowledge about this world that I haven't yet been given, that I have to do a whole lot of work to do. So I had to make choices about my priorities. What was more important, me watching another Penguins, Steelers, or Pirates game, or actually learning about the history and nature of the institutions that surround us and make all these prohibitions on our lives?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, you talk about that a lot in interviews and in your own work about this idea of constantly consuming information and trying to figure things out. And I think that's so important. You know, I've used the metaphor on this show a few times where, you know, I feel like life's a giant puzzle and every single information or thing you figure out or anything that you can gather, you know, is another puzzle piece. And as you get more puzzle pieces, the picture becomes clear on you know, what's reality and, you know, how the world really works and stuff like that. And my life goal, and I'm sure yours is too, or one of your life goals is constantly trying to gather puzzle pieces and trying to figure out in the best that you can on what's really going on and how things really work. And obviously there's just so much information out there. Sometimes it seems impossible to kind of gather as much as you want. You know, that's why I think people who say they're bored or whatever, it drives me crazy because I'm like, bored? I'm like, I don't have enough time to consume all the documentaries and podcasts and books that I barely get through. You know, I just don't have enough time to do all that, you know. So, you know, people who are bored, it's just like, it drives me crazy. It's like there's so many interesting people out there who put out interesting work, and it just, you know, it seems endless. But you know, like a person who I've had on the show quite a few times, Daniele Bignelli, who's an author and podcaster and historian. He talks a lot about, you know, this idea, and he's a professor too. And, you know, he has a similar opinion on education like you have. And, you know, I've had Thaddeus Russell and other people who are professors they all have similar, you know, opinions on this idea of just consuming information just seems pointless. This idea of just memorizing information. It's like, okay, so you know names and dates, but what's really important is figuring out, like, why is it important and how does it affect, you know, your life or your outlook on life? And that's the information you hold on to. Like, even myself, I have a hard time consuming, you know, everything I watch and everything I read. But there's bits and pieces, you know, so maybe a quote that sticks with me or maybe a certain specific fact because it relates to another thing that I read. So you're connecting dots, like that's the stuff that sticks with me. And it's like as long as I get the overall picture or I get the idea, to me, it's much more important than knowing specific names, dates and times and stuff like that where, you know, like yourself. I mean, I hear you, you know, you reference tons of books and stuff like that, and it's amazing. But somebody like me, I have a really hard time doing that, you know. So a lot of times it's like, it's if you I'll pay attention to the point you made and the why you brought up that reference, and you know that will stick with me, and maybe I'll end up losing the name or date or the book specifically.
Well, I think it comes back to priorities, and I would break, like, because this is all stuff that just goes by without being said and people don't talk about it, but this is really how you can decipher. I guess you look at these methods and these foundational elements when you get overwhelmed with, okay, I've got too many things calling for my attention in too little time, so how do I prioritize and figure it out? Because once the internet, you have a smartphone, you can access all this stuff, like, you know, and then you're not getting stuff done that you need to get done, and all these sorts of things stack up. So I like to talk about, like, the essential environmental survival knowledge that you would need to exist, and I'm going to, like, just say, for sake of making it simple, we are in our everyday lives are in a complex interrelation of dynamic elements and forces. And it's really hard for people to, you know, keep their compass pointing north and not have that interfered with by all this other magnetic circumstance and actions going on around them. So picture yourself, you're on a camping trip, you're by yourself in the mountains, and you need to stay alive during the winter for the weekend. What types of things are you going to have to do to stay alive? Well, you need shelter, you're going to need some water, you might need some food, you need to remain safe from predators and sickness, right? You got to preserve your health through the weekend. That takes a certain environmental knowledge that has been innate to human beings for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. These are things that just have to be done if you're outside and you want to survive. And then if you want to survive around other people, now you have all those base elements of survival. You know, you need to be able to eat and drink and breathe and exist and in some sort of space where you're not being attacked or bled out by predators and these other things, right? So that's just the elemental basics of being a human being on planet Earth. And then if you want to survive with other people around you, let's say in a town or city setting or one of these larger settings of a social complex, now you have all these other rules that stack on top. And this is where the ideas of freedom and slavery kind of get their start. Because if you don't know how to remain self-reliant and independent and let that be the source for your self-esteem and self-confidence, then you're going to become subjugated by one of those other social elements. People that think they can make money from you or any of these other things that go on want to use you as their labor. They want to plunder your production, right? And if you don't know how to say to keep self-reliant from that, then your priorities are going to be all messed up. You're going to become dependent. That's what the welfare state is. The government wanted to dumb down the population in the past century to the point where you can't be self-reliant. You can't be an entrepreneur because you don't know how to learn anything for yourself. And you don't know how to prioritize in the midst of all this bread and circus that they're putting out there to distract you from the real things going on. So understanding what it takes for an individual to survive, and then layering on the various priorities of being in a social dynamic, that takes up most of your time. If you're actually paying attention to what goes on, I wouldn't have time to watch the basketball game that's on tonight or whatever's going on, because there are actually things that I need to do in my life to maintain, you know, keeping the lights on and remaining safe from predators and protecting yourself from the cold of the winter and these different things that go on. You know, you might need to be learning about how to maintain your house or how to repair your snowblower. Or, you know, how to avoid a certain type of predatory animal that's been stalking the woods near your house or whatever, right? You want to protect your family and your pets from that. So there might be all sorts of different, you might have to learn to trap that animal. There's all different types of things that people could be doing to improve their lives and get more out of their time. But until you stop and think about it, these things aren't going to occur to you probably, you know? And it comes back to why it's important to have something in your social structure to reflect and to open yourself up to new ideas and this sort of thing. So that ties back to the cigar comment at the beginning.
But do you think technology, you know, so all those things, because yeah, I always laugh because I always tell my parents, it's like they don't know how to use a smartphone. But if something happened where, you know, a meteor hit the earth and we had to start all over, I'd be fucked. And, you know, they're farmers, and I was born on a farm in Portugal, up north and in northern Portugal. And, they grow their own food. They, you know, all my eggs I get are from them and their chickens. And,
I would call those old world skills. So the generality of that specific would be, what are these people like when the electricity goes off? Are they totally lost, don't know how to use a map, don't know how to feed themselves, don't know how to, you know, get clean water, keep shelter over their head, right? All the things that people had to, you know, worry about or be concerned about or at least give thought to for hundreds of thousands of years, now because of this advent of cheap and easy technology, which you could be using to help you expedite your learning curve, people were actually saying, oh, I don't need a learning curve, because they're growing up in these terrariums where they're being artificially cared for. They don't know where their food comes from. They don't know what the quality of the water they're drinking. There's all these things going on, but then they want to tell you, oh, you can't smoke here. It's like your ignorance is contributing to slavery and the evisceration of freedom, but you are going to tell me what I can and can't do. Okay. Let me just go along with that. Okay.
But are those skills going to be obsolete, because it's getting to the point where we're going to have everything's going to be automated and we're going to have cars that drive us? And, you know, I love driving. One of the most relaxing things for me is blaring some music and on a nice day, having the windows down and enjoying a ride. And, you know, but is it going to get to a point where we're going to, you know, those skills are going to be just useless? I mean, they're, you know, or is it one of those things where you think it's still important to have those skills because you, I mean, obviously you never know. I mean, things could happen where they might be relevant again, having skills like that.
Well, I would say they're obsolete. If we were in a situation where those skills would never be needed, I would say it's obsolete, like the buggy whip. I'm not going to be riding in a horse and carriage anytime soon. I don't need one of those. But if you know about something, and I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, I'm just saying if I know one thing like this can happen, there's probably others. Like a Carrington event, which I think the last event was like in 1850, but it's a type of solar storm that would fry anything that has to do with electricity here. And so you'd be going from today's modern iPhone 7 back to living like the Amish. And I say that in a very respectful way because of their preservation of old world skills and non-electrical use in a matter of minutes. And all the houses that have copper wire inside them, that copper is going to heat up from the radiation. And most of those houses are going to burn down rather quickly. So if you don't have the type of things you would need to survive over a weekend or a week or even the first month living outside because that just happened and you don't have those things close enough to a door where if the house was on fire and everyone's house was on fire and there was no fire department going to come and save you, how are you going to survive? If you don't have that type of mentality and you're watching Bread and Circus, then, you know, that's your choice. But I think you should at least know that there are these possibilities that could take away all this technology in a matter of moments or hours, certainly. That do exist in the real world. And as somebody conscious of that, I say, okay, how much trouble is it for me to have some camping equipment and some storable food and to keep it near a door so if I had to get it out of the house in a couple minutes, that's something doable, and I could continue to survive. Now, that's just one scenario out of many, 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 many that pose a threat to the you know, the living of individuals and humanity's existence as a whole. And, you know, I'm just saying, I haven't gotten to the point yet where I'm so comfortable with having to manage all those different responsibilities that I have free time for Bread and Circus. That's it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, Douglas Ruskoff, when he was on my show, you know, he's talked about how, you know, suburbs were kind of designed to keep us dependent on, you know, grocery stores and going to the market and not dependent on the community. You know, my parents grew up in a world where, you know, you would share your tomatoes with your neighbors and they would give you cucumbers or
there's a happy balance there. I think that's what you're referring to as far as time scale. There was a happy balance. People still had the old world skills if they knew if they had a piece of land they could make themselves semi self-reliant. And then learn to trade and share with other people in the area and still participate in entrepreneurial ventures that wanted to bring in food from other parts of the country, the grocery store or the market, right? But there was a time when people got a piece of property. They thought about all the things they could grow on there to be self-reliant and self-sustaining. And then they always knew they could trade with their neighbors and they would give them variety. It's the corporatization, they came in with corporate personhood. This is late 1800s, Union Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County, I believe, and that's the precedent that came about to make corporate personhood, where then the corporation will take actions that are antithetical to what individual human values are. That's kind of the larger dynamic that's played out, because what you see today is these big corporate farms are using genetically modified organisms. They're using all these poisons as pesticides. Those poisons are then accumulating inside of people who bought that stuff thinking it was food. And people today spray poison all over their property so that they can have a nice green lawn. I don't see any practicality or self-reliance survival aspect out of having a nice green lawn unless you're renting it out to somebody else that wants a nice green lawn to use. Like, I don't get that whole mentality of poisoning your property. Who knows how long or how many generations out that prohibits you from being able to grow your own food, fruit, vegetables, having any type of livestock that's not going to get tumors on your property. So it really takes away your self-reliance. So when I see everyone in my neighborhood getting their lawn sprayed by these chemicals or buying all this stuff to make the green lawn and kill off all the dandelions and, you know, take all, just pull and cut down all the trees in their yard so everyone's houses look the same. It's like I see the absence of the skill sets necessary to survive. If you take away this artificial terrarium infrastructure that's based on the use of electricity, basically. I'm not a Luddite. I use electricity. I'm also trying to use electricity in a way that makes people maybe less dependent on it, you know?
I want it so bad to buy a Tesla. I just purchased traded in my car and got another one recently, and I was looking at Teslas. I love the Model S, but it was just, they're so pricey. But my goal is to eventually have an electric car and have, solar panels on my house and be much more not be so dependent on these other corporations that kind of got you by the balls and you know, charge you what they want and really, you know, monopoly. Because, I mean, like most towns, you know, you have one cable company you can choose from, so you pay whatever they charge you. You have one electric company, you know, it's like, it's ridiculous.
Monopoly comes with extortion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
I don't think it's even about, like, someone could be listening and say, Rich, what's your problem with electricity, man? I don't have a problem with electricity. Right now, I guess my biggest problem is we've stopped learning about it like 100 years ago about this topic. And since then, they've said, oh, let's just, you know, use this highly volatile nuclear fuel to boil water. So instead of actually figuring out, like, you might be onto something with solar panels, but I would think there's a lot of different chemicals and elements that go into them that, you know, if you're not making something that lasts 50 or 60 years is more toxic to the environment than using nuclear fuels. I don't know. But all I know is it's not a perfect world. It's not going to be a perfect world. But I still think we can find a better way to make electricity than using atomic energy. Because that, you know, the resources that go into it and the dangers posed by its waste, and all you're getting out of it is boiling water to turn a turbine. That's Robert Fulton, 1800s type of technology, right? With an advanced fuel. But it's still like, we figured out how to spin some magnets and make electricity. Like, it hasn't gone like much further than that, and yet we're putting all this money into CERN and all these other experiments. It's like, wait, we can't figure out why people starve. It's not because there's not enough resources, not because there's not enough money. It's because cartels and black markets rule the world, and that monopoly mentality brings with it certain elements of tyranny and, you know, funding of both sides in conflicts to make wars because wars are profitable and they haven't figured out a better way to make money yet. That's kind of what's going on.
And it's like there's not enough food because I forget what percentage of food gets thrown out, but some ridiculous amount.
It's illegal if you want to take it from a restaurant in a dumpster and give it to people that would be willing to eat it. That's illegal to feed homeless people and do that sort of thing. And then you have the liability aspect. Let's say a restaurant wants to package up its food at the end of the night in a very respectful, you know, clean way and give it to homeless people. And it's like, no, they'll have liability problems with that. You won't be able to get insurance. There's all these other things that go into it. And it's like, why? You know, because you've got these big collective organizations that have no body to, you know, no soul to save and no body to incarcerate because they're a corporate person on paper, getting the same rights as living flesh and blood human beings, you're going to have problems. And those problems have kind of festered and gotten bigger and bigger and bigger until present day, until you have people that are so much bought into the terrarium mentality that wouldn't know how to plant a seed and grow crops or trap or fish or, you know, in some other way hunt their dinner. These, you know, it's like you have a large part of humanity living on the third floor of a structure that they've destroyed the foundation, the first and second floor on. So how long can that last?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, there is something, I mean, it's crazy. Some of the skills that we are going to be lost or seem like they're going to be lost a couple of generations away from where we are now. Because even my father, I remember the first time he had, I forget which plant it is or what the name of the term is to do this, but I'm sure you probably know when you cut, you cut a branch off one plant and you can actually attach it to another plant. And then you have like an apple tree that's growing, apples and an orange, you know, stuff like that.
I think it's called grafting.
Yeah, I think it is called grafting. Yeah, you're right. And it's, you know, I remember the first time my dad showed me that and he's like, oh, I'm like, you know, you don't know how to use a smartphone, but you just showed me something that blew my mind. Like if somebody told me that you could do that, I'd be like, you're fucking crazy. I'm like, there's no way you can do that. That sounds insane. You know, I have oranges growing on my apple tree or pears growing on my orange tree or whatever. And, but yeah, I mean, it's like little things like that, that I didn't even know. And I grew up near farmers and you know, my parents and stuff like that. And so it just, you know, a lot of those skills that are important. And I think a lot of it too, not to get all hippie, but, you know, there's something about being closer to nature. And, you know, I think there is something about, you know, even like, you know, getting a book, you know, something about the paper, the fact that that paper was alive at one time or is alive, or, you know, smoking a cigar, knowing that it's leaves that grew and it's, you know, we're all, you know, just, I don't know, just something just, the closer we get to technology, the more detached we seem to be from nature. And there's something very relaxing about it. You know, you, if you're you know, my parents have a beautiful backyard where they have this this stream that this, you know, just a small stream, but it's constantly flowing water. And, you know, they have a couple acres in the backyard. So there's sometimes animals and deer or whatever. And there's just something relaxing about being back there. And there's nothing special about it. It's not that it's beautiful, you know, it's just woods, dense woods. But it's there's something about the sounds and just being there that just is very relaxing. And, you know, I wonder if that's why we like, you know, the paper of a book or the holding a cigar and knowing it's, you know, it's just leaf, dried out leaves that are just rolled together, which is a skill within itself. You know, I mean, that's one of the big things about when, you know, a lot of the cigar companies were leaving Cuba and going to other places is that, you know, they didn't have the history of cigar rollers like they did in Cuba. And so it just, yeah, a lot of those skills that are just, you know, we take for granted. And a lot of issues with happiness in places that seem to be more modernized and, you know, and you see more drug abuse and more depression and we're overprescribed, you know, because we have anxiety and we have all these other things where you look at like blue zones, you know, places where people live the longest. I mean, they're usually, you know, never cities, you know, it's places where people live on farms and eating more natural foods. And I remember my dad growing up, and when I was a kid and he told me this, I didn't really understand it, but he's like, oh, you know, I was happier in Portugal than I am here. One day he came home from work, he was all stressed out, and he's like, oh, you know, I should have stayed in Portugal, I was happier there. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You didn't have TV in Portugal. You didn't have running water in Portugal. I'm like, we're way better off now. But he wasn't referring to the technology or the convenience things, but he was talking about just the overload of stress, you know, the overload of having these strict timelines. You have to get things done and getting, you know, the stress of even just going to get the mail and bills coming in, you know, where he grew up, where it was very simple. When the sun comes up, you get up and then you feed the animals, you go to the mountains with the sheep and goats or whatnot. And you kind of go at your own pace. Then at noon, you have a nice big lunch and you know, you have a glass of wine. And then, you know, at night, you have a big dinner with family and friends. And it's just like, it seems, you know, just like a much healthier, happier lifestyle, even though you probably didn't have all these other things that supposedly or we assume brings us convenience and happiness. So it's, you know, I think we really need to re-examine happiness. Christopher Ryan, I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He wrote Sex at Dawn, but he's working on a book called Civilized to Death. And I love his podcast, and I love his mentality, because he really argues and talks about, you know, what is progression. And even though we have progression in technology and all these other things, we think we're having progression, but do we really? And are we really progressing? You know, so I think it's a really interesting debate and conversation.
Well, I think, it's, you know, this whole idea of progress gets taken out of context. Progress in relation to what? Are we talking about skills to serve life? And by serve, I mean either make life, preserve life, or save life. So in the same way that, you know, knowing a skill of learning how to graft a plant onto another can grow new plants and maybe increase food supply, knowing how to use a smartphone to save somebody's life, you can also use it for that too. So you use it for games, or you can use it to have EMT knowledge, or, you know, any of these other types of things. At one point, you're going to have a defibrillator on an iPhone 18 or something, you know? So at some point, all these technologies, there's choice. There's your choice involved. How are you going to use it? Are you going to let it use you? Are you going to let it control you? Are you going to let it suck your time out? Or are you going to use this thing to liberate yourself and others? So I'm not anti-technology in any way. I just see a lot of people buying into technology without really thinking about what it's being used for, and historically what's been trending to lead up to its creation in the first place, because a lot of times it's not what you think it is. You know, you might see your iPhone as something, this is so convenient and brings together these other things, or you could say it's the perfect surveillance system that if Stalin wanted this 60 years ago, like, he could have taken over the world, right? Like, the things that they were trying to collect on information on people back then, it's so much easier and so much more copious these days. And people will have this idea, oh, metadata, you know, I think I know what that means. Well, let's define it as the National Security Agency defines it, and they're the ones who collect all your metadata. They said, Mike Hayden, General Mike Hayden, who was in charge of the NSA and later was the director of CIA, said they use metadata to kill people. Now, I'm not saying that to make you paranoid. I'm just saying when they need to get the drop on somebody, they collect all the metadata and they feed it into a computer model. Oh, this person's here doing this thing.
Yeah, they use it for drone attacks.
Yeah, that's what he was referring to. That's why he's like they literally use it to kill people. So you might not be the subject of a drone attack anytime soon, but the fact that you're going to have unmanned robots and unmanned aerial drones surveilling everything on this planet 24/7, it's like, oh, you know, how did we get here? That's what, you know, reading relevant history, substantial history that pertains to the cause and effect you're experiencing is useful. That's where, like, I would rather learn about how World War I, World War II, Vietnam, all these other wars transpired so we can avoid having another worldwide conflict that takes away millions, billions of lives. Because when you look at the numbers from some of these wars, it's like even World War I is kind of mind-blowing because you've got these people in this first kind of, you know, World War I is a branding concept, so, you know, take that into account. But you've got people from all these different countries participating in a war that they didn't, you know, they weren't being harassed by the Kaiser and these sorts of things. It's like they weren't, you know, personally, they were just living and they got called to action through some propaganda and they end up fighting over there. At the same time that's going on, you had a worldwide flu pandemic that starts in the middle of America on a military base, travels by train to later spread around the world during the same time. So you've got like double calamities going on, taking out, you know, so many kids from these, you know, the generations that were born to be of age at that point for service. And there's all these things that go on. It's like it's bad enough that disasters naturally occur, but we don't need to feed into these being systematically used to control the population and take away like a serious part of our work every year through taxation to support those things that are being used to take away our freedom. But you're going to be a subject of that until you learn to look outside the box you've been presented with as far as public schooling and the mainstream media. Those are the type of people that would listen to your podcast, Ricky.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, man. I mean, history is so intriguing to me. And it's crazy because I took some special ed courses in classes. I had a lot of special ed classes in high school. I was kind of I wouldn't say a bad kid, but I was, you know, early in middle school and early high school, I wasn't engaged. You know, I kind of felt like, oh, this is all bullshit. You know, I remember being going to a CCD in Catholic school. I kind of had the same idea where just like these guys just anytime you question something, they get upset instead of trying to, you know, get through to me and actually give me a good answer. And then I'm all on board. It's like all you want. If you want me to pay attention, you want me to believe what you're saying, then just give me good reasons to believe you. And but anytime you question anything, it was just always like, oh, now he's misbehaving. It's like I'm misbehaving because I'm questioning things because I'm just not, just going along
well,
with their
authority doesn't come from reason. It comes from dogma.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. You know, and then I leave high school and I mean, podcasts kind of changed my life, podcasts and documentaries, because it was just, you know, I go into the real world, you know, for lack of better terms, working full time, whatnot. And I kind of felt like my brain, you know, I still lifted weights. I played basketball. I did martial arts. I did a bunch of stuff where I physically felt like I was getting a good workout. But my mind, I kind of felt like was turned off. And, you know, even though Alex Jones, I kidded a lot about, you know, my love-hate relationship with, you know, what he's done and his work or whatnot. But he was one of, you know, his work was some of the biggest influences on myself. And I'm sure many other people who were exposed to his documentaries. And even if, you know, we think he's, you know, some people like myself think he's a little over the top and connect dots that might not necessarily be there. He at least planted the seed of doubt and planted the seed of questioning things and wondering, you know, if everything we're being told is actually truthful. And, you know, he brought me down this rabbit hole of questioning everything. And, you know, I was really into music and stuff like that. So I used to write and spend time thinking about things. And, that's one thing I loved about writing. It kind of force you to kind of also kind of reflect and gather your thoughts and put them on paper. And so all these things just became a huge influence. And, you know, everything that I know now is just based on, you know, like you said, and this goes back to what you're saying about, you know, it's not technology. Technology is not the bad thing. I mean, Joe Rogan kind of has a joke about how, you know, you can use a hammer to go around you know, hitting people in the balls, or you can build a beautiful home. You know, it's like, it's not the hammer's fault that you're going around hitting people in the dick. You know, it's just one of those things where it's just like, you can't blame the tool. You know, it's same thing with the gun thing. You know, it's like, we can go around blaming the gun for why this person shot people, or we can try to figure out, like, okay, he was on pharmaceutical drugs. Is it a pharmaceutical drugs that are causing this epidemic of people losing their mind or being emotionless and going, being able to shoot people or whatever? We don't get to the root cause of the issue. You know, we don't get to the root cause, like Chris Kesser, a functional medicine expert or doctor. He talked about how modern medicine, I think this metaphor works well with a lot of things, how modern medicine is like having a rock in your shoe and then taking Advil for the foot pain instead of taking off the shoe and getting rid of the rock. You know, you're only looking at the symptom. And I think a lot of things that we look at in life are like that. You know, we're just looking at the symptom. We're not getting to the root cause. Like, you know, how did this all happen? You brought up World War One, and I know I'm jumping to 1,000 different things like I usually do. But I think I still have some of that pre-workout I had before the gym in my system. But, when you look at World War One's a perfect example of how, you know, to understand the conflicts that's going on in the Middle East today, like, you know, knowing, understanding World War One is very important. You know, a lot of it starts off there, you know, with the Scott-Picot agreement and promising a lot of different types of people land and all that stuff. So it's, when you learn history, the interesting thing is, what's happening today makes much more sense. And I know a lot of people who I talk to are like, yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm just not into history. I'm like, well, you kind of are. Cause if you like, you know, if you like
you're
old cars,
just a spectator right now, you could be a participant.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, and I think a lot of people are into
history. A winning participant.
A lot of people are into history who don't even know it. You know, if you like old cars, you like the history of cars. If you like old music, you like the history of music, you know. So it's like everybody always thinks history as in military history, you know, history, you know, wars and generals and stuff like that. But no, history is everything that happened before now, and we can all learn from it. You know, we can learn from you talked about the engine and stuff like that. Oh, absolutely. I mean, John Brackett, who's a automotive engineer, and he's in the documentary Pump. Which is very good, and about the history of our how we got to stuck on you know, fossil fuels for our major, you know, option for engines, where we could have had ethanol and we could have, and you know, you talked about prohibition.
You could make ethanol from growing hemp. If they didn't prohibit hemp, we could be off the oil standard right now. Henry Ford made a car out of hemp. There's a whole, we could do a whole podcast just on that little topic right there.
Oh, we could, yeah. I mean, you look at I had actually James Corbett on to talk about his documentary, what the hell was it called? The one on you know, oil.
The oligarchs.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the oligarchs, how big oil conquered the world, I think is the subtitle. And then also John Brackett on Pump. And same thing. I mean, we, you know, both episodes we talked about just the history of it and how, you know, the electric car has been suppressed, you know,
the first car ran on batteries back in the 1800s. And the other person, if you haven't interviewed him yet, I think his name is David Bloom, and he wrote Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Yeah, he's another one that's really, yeah, I've thought about contacting him too, because I've seen a lot of documentary. Actually, he's in Pump, I believe
like,
he's actually.
If you're making a time capsule for the future, just in case like freedom doesn't happen right now and you want people in the future to be free, I would give him the Emperor Wears No Clothes. And alcohol could be a gas. And by unprohibiting hemp and using hemp as alcohol, I think the number was like 9 million acres of hemp would alleviate America of its dependency on oil to run automobiles and other industrial vehicles. Right? And there's 9 million, like America's huge. You could totally grow that. Plus, you could open up trade with Canada and other countries, even like Russia. Russia has a lot of land where they could be growing hemp. We could get the whole world off oil, except the whole non-elected ruling class that's in power is empowered because of the oil cartels and the diamond cartels and these other mining and mineral cartels that, you know, allow people to get together, become central bankers, print money, and control everybody else's actions by using greed, right? So, I guess the theme of this episode is there is so much to learn out there that is useful and practical to individual freedom and liberty. The fact that we don't have all this experience and knowledge and don't, like, not systematically looking for it spells out the situation that you have here. But you're not going to understand what's going on today in history if you're not familiar with the relevant history and substantial history that has had causality that's led up to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's like even the Rockefellers had a hand in prohibition because they wanted, you know, the engine to be, you know, the common engine in a car to be run off gas, you know, and diesel initially was designed to run off, I think, vegetable oil.
Sure,
you know,
was, yeah. So just learning that history right there, it's like, well, then who are these Rockefellers and how did they come to power? Oh, they controlled light. They controlled lighting fuel. You know, first it was whale oil that they were using for light, and then it moves over to the Rockefeller partner, Morgan, who grooms Tesla and funds Edison for electricity so they can maintain a monopoly on that. And then you switch back to the Rockefellers switching off of, you know, whale oil and using this new thing that was a waste product called gasoline. And now they're taking over the transportation industry. And, you know, there's fuel oil for the houses that are being used for heat during the winter. So there's a whole bunch of legitimate history where I thought when I first started hearing about it, I was like, oh, it's just cliche. No, the Rockefellers is a serious force in at least in the United States. They're not so much the global force that they grew into be at the beginning. I think they started pretty provincial and then saw that there was a game afoot. And they're like, oh, we can, you know, grow ourselves as an international corporate cartel to participate in that game. But they're not participating in that game on the side of individual liberty. They're doing so on the side that they think they have the right to rule over us as our non-elected rulers. And I think if they're so right, they should just come out in the open and we should vote on it, right?
Yeah, and I think that's why your documentary, State of Mind, The Psychology of Control, is so important, because it goes through the history of trying to control the population, you know, manufacturing consent, this idea of there's a lot of, we've talked about Edward Bernays a lot on this show, because obviously I think he's a very influential person who many people don't know who he is, and or at least don't know a lot of his history. You know, I know people who went to school for marketing or PR and they know the name and they know, oh, you know, he's the reason why I have my field of work, but they don't really know all his history.
Right. They're compartmentalized.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, yeah.
Well, there's the cause and effect of the documentary itself. Like, you watch it and you're like, oh, I learned about these things, and it's a good tool to pass along to other people so that they can come up to speed on those things. And then, so, you know, there's the viewer side of it. And then there's the side where you not only have the viewing experience, but you also have the creative experience behind it. Because it looks like one thing to the viewers, but when it comes together, like, it was a bunch of people with good intentions. Like, I co-wrote it with Kevin Cole. And the reason that we came to write it is because the writer for the original project had a conflict of interest and he decided not to work on the project. And so I was just interviewed for the movie, and then they came to me and said, would you write it? I said, I'd like to write it with a friend and research partner whose work I really respect. We went through like 40 hours of footage to like whittle it down to 3.5 hours, and then I had to deliver a 90-minute script. But because I'm a filmmaker, I took the original footage and actually cut together the whole movie. Then a week or so later, they come back and say, you know, this is really about the who and the why, but we want to show the how. So they wanted to focus more on like MK Ultra and some of these other, Bernays and Skinner and Pavlov and some of these other things where we were trying to take from the interview, because it's raw footage. You could take either set of this information from the interviews. We were trying to show like the history of who and why we're being controlled as human beings through collectivism. And they wanted it more granular, like what are the nuts and bolts of how Skinner and Pavlov and Watson and these other ideas have come to say psychologically determine people's actions. Both are important parts to show, but since I wasn't the originator of the project, I just worked on it with a team of people. We followed their lead and delivered them a script that fit what they wanted, and then they cut in the B-roll and whatnot. And then you have what you have as a viewer. You have that viewing experience. But that whole movie was changing interview by interview as people were answering the questions that the director and the producers had written for the original interviews. And so there's this whole creative process that's kind of left out of the public's view. You see that movie, it goes on 90 minutes. You're like, oh, that was good. It had some good tools in it. But where the real learning happens is when you start to take the ideas and say, what's lacking out there? What's necessary? You know, if you don't like this about a certain talk show host, instead of complaining about it, why don't you come up with what's missing, that necessary ingredient to help freedom of the individual variety spread? And so I think it's more from not only seeing a documentary like that and saying, oh, I got some useful tools out of that and I'll share it with other people, but how can that inspire you to do something likewise, to pick up, because that movie was made because those things kind of need to be in the public vernacular. They're adversely affecting individual liberty on a mass scale, but they're not being talked about, and there's not any other really good pieces of media that put it all together like that. So aside from just learning what you can learn from the documentary, there's also learning to know that you can do something similar, because none of us knew what the end product was going to look like when we started on it, and we all started into that project at different times, at different places as far as what we had learned so far. But the common theme of how are words, you know, because it's not so much actions and chains and spears used to directly control people. Most of the population on the planet are being controlled and influenced by words, and if not words, words coupled with money. And so to make a movie that kind of points a finger at that and says, look, we are losing our individual freedom, and how can we learn back the skills, the old world skills that kept us free from this in the first place? In fact, that's kind of what inspired America into being America and being separate from the British Empire, were that we realized that we could learn how to self-govern using reason if we get away from dogma as an authority. So the nature of authority is either reason-based, and it's, you know, I have an equation for that. It would be reality plus logic minus fallacies equals reason. Or you can be governed by dogma, this belief in this authority, this state, this king, whatever, you know, and the other aspect of that dogma is submission to pain, because if you don't go along with their political correctness, they'll subject you to torture or loss of freedom. And that's basically the history of mankind up to this point. And what we're trying to do, this is what I try to do on my podcast, The Peace Revolution, and I think is what Ricky tries to do in The Ripple Effect, is to show people that you can now participate in this, and instead of letting freedom go bye-bye like the dodo bird, we can say this is actually something that's necessary and essential in our lives, because you can have life, but your life's not worth much without health. And if you have life and health, that doesn't mean much if you're a slave. But to have life, health, and freedom, that seems to be the pursuit and the attainment of happiness. And I think that denying people, not only in this generation, but generations going forward, by taking away these rights and freedoms that allow individuals to experience liberty, I think it's a mistake in the process of being carried out. And the only way we can do something about it as individuals is to make little pieces of media that float out there in the internet sphere and bump into other people, maybe with open minds, and say, hey, like, I find freedom and liberty in my life to be useful. I find them to be essential to happiness. And it's something that I can't enjoy for myself unless other people have it too. I think that's the difference between freedom and slavery right there.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think the point that you made on the fact that we can all do something, we can all be a part of this movement, be a part of sharing these ideas, is so true. I think the most common email I get from listeners is people saying that they love the fact that I was just everyday Joe Schmo, had a full-time job, whatever. There's nothing special about me. I mean, yeah, I played music, but wasn't a successful musician. You know, I did music, played in a band, stuff like that. But nothing, I didn't do anything that made me famous when I started this podcast. And, I decided that my life was going down a path of unfulfillment, and I felt like I could do more, I can contribute more. And I started the podcast to try to do that. And even if I didn't have any listeners or if I couldn't get any guests, it would have been, regret is much more dangerous to me or scary to me than risk. And to do it, it was just at least an attempt to do it, I knew would bring me some sense of happiness. And then once I had kids, it gave me even more of a purpose, because it's like, you know, my goal is to try to leave this earth a little better than I received it. And especially because I want my kids to have a freedoms and a place where they can grow and enjoy life without with limited restrictions. So to me, it's just the idea of the ripple effect is so important, because I think so commonly we tell ourselves, oh, well, what difference can I make? You know, I remember starting this podcast and people telling me, well, how are you going to get guests on, or how are you going to? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, I honestly don't know. But I know I need to do something. I want to do something. And I'm just going to email people and annoy the shit out of people until people decide to come on. And, till this day, people like Douglas Ruskoff and Jason Burmis and James Corbett and Daniele Bignelli, you know, all my initial first guests who came on, and then even Dr. Brzezinski early, you know, in the life of this podcast, and Dr. Gregory Smith, all these people who were willing to come on because they listened to the show, and, you know, the common theme was they loved the fact that I was trying to do something and I was passionate about trying to do something, and I seemed like a good person who really just wanted to share ideas and do my part in trying to make the world a better place. And I think that's what we need to do. You know, this goes back to what we talked about with, you know, you never bring up politics. Never. It's like, no, we should be sharing ideas, and we should be able to do it in a civil manner where we're not arguing and fighting. And I mean, unfortunately, I emotions and ideas and thoughts go hand in hand, and, you know, they're not two different things. You know, we are emotional animals, and you know, that obviously does have some effect on the way we perceive things and you know, the logics that we come up with and stuff like that. But I think that, you know, we need to get conversation can't be a lost art. It can't be. I think it's something we need to hold on to, and we need to. And I think that, you know, we are in the middle of a social experiment where people are more comfortable text messaging and then they are talking face to face. They're more comfortable, you know, writing something on Facebook than they are talking to their friends face to face. So I think that, you know, we need to change that. We need to focus on how important it is to get together, talk, have conversations, share ideas. And when you do that, you know, I had Mariana Venzeller, who did the show on the Travel Channel called Breaking Borders, and she would get people from two sides of a conflict or of a debate, you know, somebody from Palestine and somebody from Israel and somebody from Texas and somebody from Mexico, you know, or Border Patrol or whatever. And she would sit them down and they'd eat and they'd drink, and it would bring people together. And when you meet these people who the TV or media or whoever has programmed you to hate or dislike or to convince you that they're much different than you are, when you meet them in person, you realize they're not that much different. They also want the freedoms that, you know, you've talked about, and they want just a safe environment for their families and kids and friends and places where they can do the things they enjoy in life. And I think we need to focus on that. We need to focus on one, that we can all make a difference, and even if it's just a little difference, you know, your podcast has influenced many of people. I mean, I've heard so many people that I'm a fan of talk about how influential your work is and how important your website is, and even myself. I mean, I've learned so much from listening to interviews to going on, you know, your documentaries, your website, and, you know, so, and maybe myself, maybe I'm not going to make a huge difference in the world, but there could be some kid listening right now on his way to school or whatever, and he could be the next great mind, and he's going to be influenced by, you know, by Richard Grove and maybe James Corbett or whoever, other really interesting, smart people. So I think that, you know, we have to focus on the fact that, you know, even if we just cause a little ripple, and that's why it's called the Ripple Effect podcast, because I truly believe in this idea of the ripple effect, this idea that even if I just change the perspective on one person, he's going to maybe have a conversation with somebody else and maybe change his opinion or perspective or open his mind, and it'll continue and continue and continue. And you know, that's where power really comes from. This, you know, once we decide that we can't do anything, then we've lost.
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there. So I'm going to go back to the beginning where you talk about Dr. Brzezinski, the cancer cure guy, as opposed to Dr. Brzezinski, the geopolitical strategist of the New World Order. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, for sake of history, that would have just thrown people for a loop. They're like, he interviewed Zbigniew Brzezinski? What kind of podcast is this? No. And so then you were talking about synergy, because basically, like, I'm not an egocentric person that thinks like I'm going to fix all these problems. I just want to help to spark the fires of curiosity and inventive nature that do solve these problems. I'd like to live in a world where some of these problems weren't so stupidly managed. I'm not so naive as to think we're going to live in a world with no problems and no violence. It's like violence is part of getting to freedom, because when people are oppressed, if you prevent them from actually rising up and doing anything to change anything, then that's like the absence of liberty and freedom in the first place. So that's like peace on the terms of the New World Order. They will just suppress all resistance and take that out of human beingness and take away emotions and, you know, all these sorts of things. So like, that's not the way to go. So it's about, first off, having realistic expectations or no expectations and just going from what the causality and the evidence dictates. So this gets into like a basic philosophical premise. If your whole podcast is about causality, I'm for that. I recognize causality exists. And if you, on the listening end, you recognize causality exists, then we're all on the same page. Isn't that beautiful? We all recognize there's some sort of causality going on. And this ties back into this idea we talked about before. You were saying how politics and religion, oh, we shouldn't talk about those things in polite company. That's the kind of historical euphemism of those two topics. Well, guess what? Those are the two topics most used to deceive people through lying. So maybe we should talk about these things. Maybe we don't need these political and religious crutches that we're using. And we, you know, use reason based with, you know, coupling that up to what is objective reality and take away the fallacies of that thinking. And then we can all communicate pretty efficiently. And I think this is what should drive. I'm not telling anyone what to do. I'm just observing that over history, it seems to drive people's priorities. Like if you're hot or cold or hungry or you need shelter or you need protection from a predator, that's probably going to take priority over bread and circus. So the fact that we have so many people today, you know, playing on their phones, playing on their video games, all these sorts of things, bread and circus, fantasy football leagues, all this sort of stuff, that means that your basic shelter and your food and your water and protection from most obvious predators that you think of have all been taken care of. So congratulations. We're all living in a semi-civilized world where we can actually have time in our day, either for the cocktail and cigar or the smartphone and some games. Right? Like that does show progress in history, because for a long time you were either just shivering through the night, or you're looking for firewood, or you're trying to make a spear to protect yourself from whatever predator's trying to eat you because you're part of the food chain, until you use reason and technology to make yourself, you know, an apex predator. And that's the nature of life, Simba. This is what's going on the planet. So, you know, there are these things that are out there that drive the priorities, because there is a causal nature. It doesn't just go away because you imagine it doesn't exist, right? So there's the basic environmental survival knowledge, and then once you get that under control, then if you'd like to attain like a comprehensive understanding of everything, that's the desire level. Those are your wants. What I was talking about before, those are your needs. Those are the needs of survival, and then after you have those taken care of, you can kind of engage in these other things that you want to understand or to do or to, you know, participate in or to spectate on. So all these different skills that we need to survive life, to enjoy life, to have freedom, have been kind of thrown up in the air and scattered to the wind. And that the purpose of that is to distract everybody so that they can get you away from the knowledge you actually need to survive and maintain your freedom, to everybody over here into this cow pen so we can utilize your energy in a way that you wouldn't necessarily agree with. Right? And so, yep. If anything, you know, as a means of just having conversations and letting people just, you know, speak their mind, you're playing a serious effect. You know, it's a serious role with an amazing causal effect, because the nature of what we're doing right now, as far as just moving some sound around and capturing it through a little electronic means to preserve it for people in the future, it's pretty amazing technology in and of itself. And you never know where your podcast or my podcast or Corbett's podcast or all of our podcasts left together in some sort of time capsule for people in the future can do. Because if they're not already enjoying their freedom, we're certainly identifying the keys and the different cogs and gears and mechanisms involved in suppressing freedom and tyranny. And we're figuring out how to throw shoes into that machine. You know, they used to call that sabotage, the throwing of the shoe. But really, if you see a machine that's all it's doing is cranking out slavery and tyranny, then what do you want to do? You want to participate in league with that, and you want to contribute to the loss of human beingness so that we can all just go back to, you know, how things were for thousands of years, living under oppression of people who, you know, schemed or dreamed themselves to be a king? Because for a long time, you know, you were born into a society and you were either the royal ruling class, or more likely you were a serf, you were a slave, you were, you know, in the feudal system. You didn't own things, and things that you worked and produced could be taken and plundered from you. So that's why the ideas of freedom were kind of necessary in human history, and why they're so fragile, and why I think it's important that we use any and all means of technology to preserve, you know, these ideas, to locate them first and to share them with others.
Yeah, that's so important. And you keep talking about freedoms, and I think that people have this idea that we need some type of structure or somebody to make decisions for us, because if not, people will commit crimes or do harm. But I mean, people still, you know, commit crimes even though there's punishments for it, you know, right? So it doesn't stop people from doing stuff. I mean, it's,
and
like,
what are the punishments? The punishments are they're going to take away your freedom. So when people give those kind of cynicisms, those parroting of other people's ideas back to me, I say, well, first, you know, think about yourself. if this conversation just leads to you not taking actions that take away other people's freedoms, of not voting for people who take away other people's freedoms and put them in cages, a lot of times unjustly, without evidence these days, without committing a crime. There's a lot of people, there's millions of people in jail right now who didn't commit any crime against another person.
There's people in Nevada who are doing life in prison for a substance that is now legal in like 9 states, you know, for marijuana. You know, it's crazy.
Right. So there's a lot to the steps we take. If you're working a job and you're paying a lot of money into the taxes and those taxes are being used to kill innocent people around the world, then like, is it really worth making like to doing that? And what are you doing while you're spending your time fulfilling somebody else's dream in exchange for money with like the printed pictures on it? Right. Like, what is the belief behind that whole system if it has no integrity? Right. So there's all these different layers to figure out and nobody can do that thinking for you. And, you know, I just like people to know that there are options to the things that they're doing that they think are so boring and costly to their integrity anyway. It's like, hey, there's other options out there. I'm not telling you what to do. I wouldn't want to be told what to do. You know, I just like to let people know, hey, there's more on the menu. Flip it over. There's more on the menu here than what they're showing you.
And I think for the most part, if you don't have, you don't need police, you don't need certain things to tell you not to do things or you'll go off and do it. You know, it's, I used to make the argument that people are like, you know, you get the old timers are like, oh, once weed's legal, then everybody's going to be high all the time. It's like, no.
They're high all the time on lies.
Can we
just try high on something else then?
In Portugal, they decriminalized all drugs in 2001, and my parents actually didn't know this. So they would go back to Portugal, and they would come back, you know, on vacations. And I remember one day, I'm just like, you know, they decriminalized all drugs in 2001. They're like, oh, no, that's not true. And they're like, what do you mean it's not true? They're like, I didn't see anybody doing drugs. And I'm like, yeah, because nothing changed. You know, nothing changed what I mean is by nothing changed is that you didn't have this epidemic of people doing drugs on the street because – the reason I don't do heroin isn't because it's illegal. It's because I don't want to do heroin. So it's not like because it's free to do or because it's decriminalized.
You know, you don't jump off that cliff because there's a law against it, right? There's a law against
exactly.
The law, right?
You know, there's a good
who
TED talk.
Who would do the rose if there wasn't an authority?
You know, and there's a good TED talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
And this guy was arguing. Oh, I don't know if he was arguing, debating. I mean, he was kind of making the point that they had this little experiment where they had this kid pretending he was homeless and he was freezing and they're filming people walk by and it was in the middle of the winter and I don't know if it was New York or what city it was and people are going by and nobody stops or says anything and then this guy comes by and he's like, hey, you know, you cold? He's like, you know, take my jacket, this and that, you know, and he's talking to this kid. He's like, hey, you're just a kid. What are you doing out here? And then he's like, you know, I'm homeless too. We got to look after each other. And he was making the argument that, you know, this guy who had very little, you know, he was the first one to help this kid. And they
because
did the same.
Because he had very little, that he's open to empathy. He understood.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He wasn't so far removed that he couldn't imagine being homeless or cold or any of these things. And I think that did he do that because there was a law that mandated him to act like a human being, or did he do it just because it was the right thing to do?
Exactly.
And that's probably why he's homeless, because he's somebody who follows what he thinks is right, follows his conscience to do the right thing, where he could be gainfully employed if he was willing to abuse the integrity of other people and take advantage of them through lying. Right.
Well, you work in the corporate world, and you know, we have a family-owned construction company, so I deal with a lot of corporate, you know, world people, and very cutthroat, profit first, morals last, you know, type of mentality. Did you struggle dealing in that type of world? You know, because it seems like very out of your personality. You know, you seem like a really nice guy and somebody who has a very calibrated, you know, moral compass. How did you handle that? Did you feel like these are my type of people, or were you lost in that type of philosophy and mentality? And then, you know, maybe September 11th incident, which all my listeners are going to be pissed off about because I haven't brought it up yet, an hour and a half into the conversation. But you know, did something like that change your mentality? Like, did you struggle? You know, dealing with that,
opened my eyes to the, you know, a bigger picture going on. And the way I'd answer your question is, you know, I started out as an entrepreneur in college, and when you're doing sales as an entrepreneur, the goal is to build relationships and repeat customers, not to dick people over. So you're focused strategically and strictly on meeting their needs, asking them questions, find out what they need, and make up a plan that you can deliver that within a set amount of time and a set budget. And if you can maintain that and they pay you, then that's a successful relationship and you're both happy, right? So, you know, using that skill set out of college to get my first job, excelling at that job because it was a small, maybe 40-person company at that point, to get another job in a small company that maybe had a couple hundred people that then got purchased. So basically all these small companies I was working for that had this, you know, family mentality where you're not there to dick people over, you're there to do the right thing. These were all small companies that eventually, once you become successful, they were getting gobbled up by larger companies. The corporate culture of those larger companies is what, you know, either knowing that's coming up or seeing it happen is something to make you switch jobs, because you're seeking to preserve that, you know, where you look people in the eye and you don't dick them over mentality. These corporate jobs have a, you know, profit at all costs, including human beings strategy. And so definitely later in my career, I was more in tune with that. Not being, you know, present at Ground Zero on 9/11 definitely opened my eyes up to, I don't know. I thought I had a pretty good idea of how the world works, and that's all just wiped off the page in a series of minutes. And you see things that are being called accidents that look very unaccidental. Then trying to continue to work in a corporate world where you've already recognized that they're willing to, you know, do things that are uncouth or against, you know, personal standards of integrity, and expect you to go along with it just because they pay you some pieces of paper with funny pictures painted on them, right? So it's like, you know, I see a lot of people. I don't think that money is the root of all evil, but I do think that money stimulates greed. And that when you put yourself in a situation where that you can never have enough of that which you don't need, you know, you need resources and trade and communication with other people likely to survive. But there's a certain point where they're paying people just exorbitant amounts of money to do the wrong thing and screw other people over. And I think that's the fine line that exists in all these organizations, but is more prevalent in the ones that are larger and larger and have thousands or tens of thousands of people and make billions and billions of dollars and are owned by people who are, like, you know, the fundraisers for Cheney and Bush and become ambassadors afterwards. It's like, once you're getting to that level of you're working for a company that's run by a globalist, I would think there's a lot lacking in that corporate culture. Otherwise, it couldn't exist on that level, because there's a very distinct line between, like, your mom and pop shops and big corporate international conglomerates that treat everybody as a number. And as an employee, if you're going to go someplace and you have a good skill set and you're going to make money and be successful basically anywhere you go, why would you go work at the company that is more and more fascist and less people oriented, where human resources becomes not a department to help you? It becomes a department that seeks to use you as a human resource, and that is expendable, that sort of thing, right? So you see that going on in a lot of companies. And what's the way out of that? You know, there's some of the things that I say and you're like, oh, this is all heading downhill. Well, at the same time, there's people waking up and learning and strategizing and learning to overcome these problems, to create inventive new solutions and companies that help to offset the balance. So at the same time that you're watching, like, Humpty Dumpty fall off the wall, and not be put back together again, you see people not needing the wall in the first place, getting rid of the divide and conquer, because we recognize we have certain traits that are, you know, inalienable to all human beings, and we should respect those traits, that we all have certain needs. But at the same time, we're learning to be self-reliant and not expecting some centralized welfare authority to take care of all of us or to provide for us. So with the removal of that terrarium mentality where everything's being artificially purveyed and propagated, you get back to a natural setting where people have a little bit more land, or, you know, that they're living on, and they're growing food that helps them be self-reliant, and they're possessing the skills and teaching those skills to the next generation that helps preserve any semblance of connecting to objective reality, which is where reason and our needs and all these faculties of physical and mental capabilities of human beings all coalesce. And so I think it's getting back to the things that we need to survive and knowing the difference between our wants and our needs, and avoiding the dogma that kind of throttles or is a governor on our individual liberty, and just sticking to, you know, honest reason and communication skills that, you know, treat people as equals. And if somebody, you know, acts in a way that you don't think they should be treated as equal, at least you gave them the benefit of the doubt. Like, if people want to be ignorant, they have a right to that. I just think that we should, you know, people who want to be ignorant, we should just maybe keep them, you know, being independently ignorant and not seek to empower their collective ignorance. That's kind of what you have here.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But does it seem like our environment, like it's hard to keep that going because our environment, technology, everything's changing quicker than like the human is almost. You know, I brought up that documentary, The Perfect Human Diet. It's really good because it really goes into the history of what humans ate and how we lived and probably one of the best documentaries because he doesn't just talk to nutritionists and stuff like that, but he talks to historians and it really goes through the history of civilization and before agriculture and even our caveman ancestors and stuff like that. Kind of like eating like the paleo diet and stuff like that and all that type of stuff. And you know, I think that it almost seems like you look at our food, you look at our phones, you look at our cars, our our jobs, instead of, just a couple of generations ago, if you had a job, more than likely you did things with your hands, you were physically active. Our bodies are designed to move, it's like that saying that people are using now, sitting is the new smoking, it's just as harmful to your body and it's having, equally the same type of negative effect on society. And how much of it is because, technology and all this, the things around us are changing so quickly, but the human body and our needs and maybe even our wants, those things are still there. They haven't changed that much, but yet we just haven't adapted to, this new, maybe this path we're going down, this new lifestyle that eventually we're going to be living where everything is going to be public and there's going to be no privacy and all this stuff. And maybe that's just what it is. Maybe.
Well, I think that's what happened. Is that they've redefined what progress is. So to me, if I want to make progress, was it progressing toward freedom or health or life and well-being for my family? Like that's my idea of progress. The other ideas of progress by these corporations is, can we make more money at the expense of human beings and damage to the planet? So the ideas of progress of individuals has kind of been usurped by these illusory ideas of progress on the nature of the corporate persons or the corporate individuals. And that skews people's priorities because then they start to take on the priorities and the characteristics of these corporate collectives instead of being in touch with objective reality, that which they need to survive. And so that's kind of the dichotomy that has been artificially created. And in its absence, things just return to normal. In the absence of these big magnetic ideas by these corporate persons that affect, billions and billions of people, people will naturally say, what else is there to do? Oh, it's going to rain or it's going to snow or I need to, patch my shelter. I need to catch some food. I need to prepare some food. I need to hunt some, there's this whole cycle of life that must be maintained the whole time for life to continue occurring. And in the absence of these big magnetic structures that have been, brought together with billions and billions of dollars to control people's influence, both on the consumer as well as the producer ends of it. In the absence of all that, people just do what's natural to get along with each other and survive and to not, seek out unwanted conflicts that have, they're seeking certainty. They're seeking the use of reason in ways that actually benefits them. You grow up in a world today and then people were like, you have to be skeptical. To me, just being skeptical without any of the other ingredients is pretty much a mistake. It's like saying, go into the grocery store. I want you to read all the labels on all the products. Now, keeping in mind, this is just a metaphor because real food doesn't have labels. But, going to a grocery store, now you got to read all the labels. Now you got to understand all the ingredients. You could do all of that and still not know what to eat for dinner tonight because your priorities aren't coming from what does my body need to survive and maintain itself. If you know that, then you would know which ingredients you need from that store to eat. But just being openly skeptical is like reading all those labels, reading all those ingredients, and still not knowing what you need to eat tonight.
Yeah, and and this goes to the general idea of this conversation. This idea that money isn't necessarily, like you said, the root cause of all evil. But even when it comes down to food, you look at like the sugar industry. How so? In other words, you create an industry. They're making money. They want to make more money. So it's greed that's kind of influencing.
Well, and then
this.
It becomes a cartel and a monopoly because if they didn't need to do those things to maintain its power, they wouldn't need to form a cartel or monopoly. It would just be industry. Industry in and of itself says, things that are needed will be produced and things that aren't needed will go out of business. Well, whatever happened to that, during the bank bailouts, those businesses that failed should have gone out of business. They shouldn't have been bailed out. And you can tell who's in control when they get bailed out. They are. Like they created the problem and got paid for it. That's the opposite of, making a mistake and learning from it and improving. that's being paid to continue making mistakes. It gives them, you know, gives the world a bigger risk from doing that because no lessons have been learned. Nobody, it's just like after 9/11, nobody got fired. Everyone who did their job got promoted.
Yeah. Similar to, you know, unlike Pearl Harbor, right, where people actually...
Who were punished in that really had nothing to do in it.
Yeah, that was more, for just public...
Admiral Kimmel, I think he spent a lot of time on the stand. And, you know, it wasn't his fault that both the American... Well, first, the British, the preeminent book to read on it that doesn't really deal with Pearl Harbor, but the essence of how Pearl Harbor happened is in that book. It's called The Double Cross System by the ex-director of MI6, John Cecil Masterman. And in there, he says that the spies that were in on the planning of Pearl Harbor were British spies, that they brought them over to J. Edgar Hoover. The spy's name was Dusko Pop. Oh, his name is Dusan Popov, but his popular name is Dusko, which is kind of a nickname. He was Agent Tricycle. And in this book, The Double Cross System of World War II, Masterman, the ex-head of CIA, or of MI6, that was almost a Freudian slip right there. There's not much difference between CIA and MI6. He says, he's like, we knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor in August of, you know, 1941. He says, we knew about this. We'd cracked their codes. Their spies were our spies. We had the questionnaires. We, you know, kind of hinted at the, you know, to the Americans about this, but we did so in a way that wasn't believable so that they would continue ignoring it as a piece of evidence. And he said, and we couldn't disclose it to the Americans because we were so, it was such in a like fledgling intelligence relationship. We didn't want to blow it. And then this is backed up by, the Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch, where they're cracking the Enigma code and all this sort of stuff. And that's not even the first precedent. The first precedent will be World War I in this room called Room 40, which Admiral of the Ministry, the Navy, Churchill, was working in this room where they're cracking secret codes. So they knew that the German U-boat was going to sink the Lusitania and knew its whereabouts the whole time up to the attack, because you can read the decrypted codes that are in the archives in Britain. So it's known back then. They knew about these events. They didn't tell their good friends, the Americans, in this special relationship, because they needed America to get in both of those wars. So rather than like the children's fable of Pearl Harbor, where we're just like sitting around doing nothing, gotten attacked, there is the fact that the Americans broke the Japanese diplomatic purple codes. There's the fact that we had provoked them by doing different acts of diplomacy that put them in a position to go to war with us. There was all these other layers, and it's like you can't really know what's going on until you independently evaluate all those different layers of evidence and make a decision for yourself. Because I would argue that no story you've ever been told is accurate to the events and the evidence and the data you can accumulate for yourself if you actually looked.
And
with a little help of other people that have found interesting nuggets. I'm just saying, if these nuggets exist, there are likely more that tell other layers we haven't yet explored yet. And so it's definitely not as simple as December 7th, 1941, you know, a day they'll live in infamy, the famous quote, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the same thing with 9/11.
Knowledge.
You know, it depends on how much you know about world history, and then you juxtapose that to the official story. If you want to, you know, say the Arab terrorists, okay, yeah, there's a whole history of MI6 and CIA grooming Arabs and Muslims as terrorist groups, as proxy groups to incite wars. Okay, so there's Operation Northwoods. There's all these other layers of history that come into it. And then you can look at that official story and say, oh, well, in some ways they are telling the truth. It's just not the way that everyone thinks of it as.
Yeah.
Well, that gets back to propaganda and Bernays and these other psychological uses of words to trick and control people and to get you to not resist when you should be resisting. And that's why I look at things in terms of freedom and slavery, both physical and intellectual. And if you can manage those two fronts, all this other stuff, this noise, this celebrity, all this other stuff that goes on, it kind of you tune it out as noise because you've focused into the signal. The signal is that which you need to survive as an individual and what you need to do to get along with other people in groups and preserve yourself and your life and you know, pursue happiness in the midst of all this other chaos and noise that goes on out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why James Perloff's book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, I believe it's that one, and even the documentary 9/11, A New Pearl Harbor, I think both of those works are important because what they do before they get into 9/11, they show you how the same type of tricks, the same type of propaganda, the same type of influences and the same reasons. I mean, it's always to get into war or to scare the public into making an irrational decision or emotional decision It's happened throughout history over and over again. And I think 9/11, because we're alive to see it, we're very emotionally attached to the events. I mean, even seeing the videos now, even though I've seen them a trillion times, it still, you know, gives me goosebumps to think about everybody who was harmed and died because of those events. You know, it's easier to start with, you know, look back in history, look back at history, look at the other times this stuff has happened. And when you do that, oh, did my Pro Tool stop? No.
I got a backup recording if your Pro Tools crashed out.
Oh, there we go.
Was that a good O or a bad O?
No. I think I picked up on it. I heard something in my microphone and I picked up on it immediately. So I think I probably lost like 50 seconds, if that. So it's, you know, we're all right. That's the thing.
Like I said, if you need my end of the raw recording, you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, well, I used to use Super Tintin all the time. I don't know how I got exposed to that one, but I used that for a long time. And then, you know, when people would say how they had issues with it, I'm always like, oh, not me. I've had good luck with it. And then out of nowhere, like in the last like 6 months, maybe 7 months, 8 months, something like that, it was so inconsistent. Randomly, it would actually record the audio most of the time, but it would almost never record the video anymore. And luckily, a lot of the podcasts recently have been audio only, so I wouldn't have a video episode to work on anyways. But it is always nice, because I remember Thaddeus Russell was one where I remember I worked to get him on for like forever, and then finally I get him on, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if I forgot to hit record or what, but you know, it's deceiving, because once I hit record on the tracks just to make them alive, I can hear myself talk, but I actually didn't hit record, so I started recording. So next thing you know, I finish the conversation. I'm like, holy shit, I didn't record any of that. And then thank God that Super Tintin, that ridiculous name for software, end up recording it. And I end up having to use that, but it end up being just the audio through my computer, you know, microphone, not my actual nice microphone. So it sounded kind of shitty. But, you know, it was
better than a total loss.
Yeah, yeah. So
I use that screen capture program I sent you. As long as I remember to turn it on, it works. It saves it real time. So when I press stop, there's no save. It's already saved, which is nice. I've never had it crash. And if you forget to turn it off, you can record, like, I'm sure, for a couple days before it would, like, eat up enough storage to have to crash. So,
is there a setting where it would turn on automatically when you? Because that's the nice thing I like about Super Tintin. The second the Skype conversation started, it would start recording automatically when it worked.
Yeah, this isn't that intuitive. But what you should do, since you're in the business of podcasting and doing interviews, is create multiple layers of redundancy. So continue to use Super Tintin, knowing that it doesn't work all the time, and then run your screen capture on top of that. And if one crashes, it's likely the other won't. And as a tertiary, you take audio out and run that into like a Zoom recorder or something.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get one too, to just to do like I use my phone.
I mean,
once.
If you want to make this part of the podcast, the fact that you had technical issues, which is legit, I could just give you like my process for doing that for film, because there's like a whole life lesson to be learned right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I usually don't cut out anything unless the whoever the guest is wants me to cut something out. But it's weird. I kind of like the casual
vibe of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I'm gonna drop this story, because basically, as a filmmaker, unless you're working in Hollywood with $100 million productions, like, you do need to have a lot of self-reliance and resourcefulness, because you're like a one-man team. You got to kind of know how to do everything. And one of the most important things you learn as somebody who has to be jack of all trades and master of all trades to carry out a production is that it does no good to shoot a bunch of video if you don't have the corresponding sound, especially if it's an interview, right? So is you know, my theory is you use as many cameras as you have, and you have at least three different types of audio recording. And if not, you're going to end up getting caught in one of those situations where you did a really great interview, but there's a refrigerator hum or something really annoying that takes away from the whole audio experience. And when you think about it, audio is like 75% of making a film, because you know, as long as you have clean audio, people will pay attention. You can put cats playing with string or something up there on the screen. You can, there's other ways to creatively cover it. But if you've got a filmed interview with somebody and they look great and they're composed great and it's great lighting and good saturation and all these good things, but you can't hear them clearly and you can't hear it well enough to transcribe it to make subtitles, I mean, you've wasted everybody's time and effort with that. So as a filmmaker, that's one of the things that, I mean, I learned it from podcasting, but you don't need as many redundancies, but it's not a bad idea. You know, two software types of recording plus a hardware type of recording for an interview, because in a documentary setting, things never happen the same way twice.
Yeah.
And because we're not all going from a script and we don't have some big Hollywood production, it's like, no, it's like that which you just lost, or that which you just had bad audio quality, or that which you just forgot to turn this one mic on the switchboard when the Zoom recorder with the open mics to the air would have gotten it. You know, there's all these different forms of redundancy that can really help individual producers, whether doing podcasts or videos or any of these types of individual communication metaphors that we have available these days so cheaply, successfully. And without that, you have to wait till you make that mistake. Like, as a for instance, and I'm not in any way saying this to be derogatory to the other people in my story, but I was in DC in October, and we were filming six different, you know, interviews with, first off, Ray McGovern. I've studied up for my interview questions by listening to all of, you know, a whole bunch of his interviews, one of which was yours. Very well done. In fact, I think you had more than one interview with Ray, or just maybe you did your second one with him as I got back from that trip.
Yeah, but, I think I did. Yeah.
So first, to go on the trip, it's like you got to have budget. And my buddy had raised some money through his Indiegogo, which made me inspired to do a similar Indiegogo campaign. And we combined the streams of that productivity in, you know, he booked the trip. He paid for the hotel. We both aligned people to interview. I did most of the research to make the interview questions. We both added equipment to the situation, which then there's a little conflict. He wants to do things really simple, and I like to have redundancy. And had we not done redundancy, we would have lost some very good footage. For instance, you might be able to take the world's best shotgun microphone and mount it on a really nice boom pole and have it and listen to it, and you're getting clear audio, and find out when you get back to your editing desk, oh, wait, you can hear the elevator going up and down in the building the whole time because it's vibrating through the concrete floor that you had the microphone kind of pointed down to. And discover that you need to go from the lapel mic as an input because it's not picking up that noise. Or even if those two didn't work, we had another tertiary recorder in the room. And then the fallback, the scratch audio, you would call it, would be coming from the mics that go into the cameras. So you're going to be hard pressed with those types of levels redundancy to not get what Ray McGovern said over that several hour period, which, by the way, is never going to be said the same way again. Right.
Exactly.
So when you're documenting something that's like a live event, it's unscripted, it's unrehearsed, it's spontaneous. That's where you owe it to put a little extra time and energy and understanding into the redundancy aspect. Also with the cameras, my buddy was like, we don't need to shoot with all the cameras you brought. I'm like, I'm going to shoot with every camera I brought. That's why I brought them, to have redundancy. If we don't use three of these camera angles, then think about the camera angles we use. They'll be outstanding. They'll be stellar. You never know until you get back to your editing desk that, oh, look, you can totally see these wires in the background, or there's something really distracting that you couldn't see in the midst of an impromptu studio in a hotel room.
Yep.
So knowing that these things happen and being able to plan and have the resources to bring to bear on that situation can really ensure that you get the highest quality productive effort, productivity, if you will, as well as production value out of the scenario. And it's like, I'm never going to go back and invest my life's energy in that situation again the same way. So that took a lot of, doing on our part, planning on our part, research and organization on our part. You don't want that to be wasted either. So I like to try to do my best at any given time when I show up to events like that. And if you do that, I think people recognize it. They recognize that there is a difference in quality. There's a difference in quantity, because when you're doing quality, you have innately more to give out through that same medium. You're not taking away and making people wish I would have done something else during that time, you know? So there's a lot to it.
Yeah, and even just having all those camera angles, something as simple as, because one thing I liked about State of Mind was the fact that there was a lot going on. So you had somebody talking, you'd show them talking, and then you would show clips, little images of cartoons or some old film or whatever, and people have short attention spans. So even just changing angles, you know, it's like doing like what music videos kind of figured out a long time ago. It's like constantly changing things, you know, changing angles, changing, even if it's the same scene, but you're changing angles, it keeps people engaged. And, I think
they kind of abuse that. But what we do is try to use that same knowledge to heal that abuse. Like a music video that's not worth watching can be cut in such a way that it's interesting to just about anybody who has eyes. Even if you don't like the music, even if you don't like the concept, they know how to manipulate people to that level. What I try to do is just take the general aspects of how to communicate through the visual medium of film and say, all right, well, you know, if you have an establishing shot, a mid shot, and a close up, and then you cut in some B-roll, which is other footage that is relevant to what the person's saying at that given time. That's what you were referring to before. But let's call that B-roll or cut-ins or cutaways, where you're cutting away from the person who's talking and showing something else. Those are all types of the same thing. And if you rotate those in a, you know, establishing shot, mid-view, close-up on something that they're making a point, and then cutting back to the person asking the question, establishing shot, mid-shot, person making a point, you know, that's very easy for people to intake. So you're meeting their demand for high production value without having to go to the dishonest point and saying, I am cutting now just to make sure you keep watching and you can't go, you know, pursue your will freely. Because that's what was being done in the first case, like the MTV case, where they're just like so much visual and so little substance. That's why they have to cut it like that, right? So, again, technology can be used to take away your freedom, but technology, if you apply thinking to it, can also be used to preserve and expand your freedom. And I try to do the latter. I call that education. You know, it's voluntary. Nobody's being forced to do it, and as opposed to propaganda, which would be the first case where, like, you're being filled with untruths when you think you're getting the truth. And not being able to notice the difference between fact and fiction or reality and non-reality, I think, is a form of psychological control that we brought out in State of Mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, you keep going back to the theme that, you know, being lied to and propaganda. I mean, there's so much, like, even like we talked about history, there's so much that's been written in history that there's so many conflicting opinions and perspectives. And you talk to people from other countries and they have a different opinion or perspective on what happened. And, you know, obviously events, you know, one person's freedom fighters, another person's terrorists. And, you know, I had Manuel Rosa on who did the book, The Untold History. I believe it's called The Untold History of Christopher Columbus or something like that. It's along those lines. And, you know, he had all this evidence and all this research that proved that he wasn't who we've been told. And he's one of the most popular, best known, you know, historic figure, you know, in America. And yet, like, almost everything we've been told about him is a lie. You know, Gerard Williams, the same thing with, you know, his book, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. I remember when he was first on the podcast, my friends would be like, no, there's no way. And I'm like, well, look at it. There's zero evidence of what, you know, the mainstream story, historic story is. You know, there's zero evidence that he survived and you know, killed himself or whatever in Germany. And it's so all these things that we've been told and we almost don't question them and we just kind of go along with it because it's like, well, if this many people believe it, then it must be true. So we just continue regurgitating that historical event or that story the way we were told. You know, I think sometimes it's hard to get people to accept the fact maybe they've been lied to. You know, maybe what they see or their reality isn't necessarily things aren't what they seem. And I think that's a hard thing to do, you know, and I think that, you know, podcasts like this, your interviews, your podcasts, your documentaries, I think it kind of chips away at it where it's like if you can kind of just take baby steps, you know, it's it works their way to that. And, you know, like I said before, you know, I have kids. I don't know if you have children or not, but that's one thing I really worry about. You know, it's like I want to do my best to make sure that they're thinkers or they, you know, obviously, we've created a world where they have to survive. They have to obviously get a job and eventually, you know, survive and financially. So they have to accept some, I guess, some properties of our society. But, you know, I still want them to question things and I still want them to be able to think, you know. And I remember having James Corbett on. We're talking about, you know, he had, you know, he had a second kid not too long ago, and I think our kids are probably close in age. But, you know, he was talking about how the most important thing he can teach his kid is how to think. And that kind of stuck with me, you know. And, you know, I have a friend who's a teacher who said, we shouldn't be teaching kids anything they can look up, you know, which is another, you know, quote that kind of stuck with me. And it's like, so it's all these things where just like the, if you can just teach your kid how to think and question things, you know, it just, that alone is probably the best. And even question myself, because I'm not always right. I have people on the show all the time that I don't necessarily agree with everything they say, but I'm willing to listen and I'm willing to let my opinions change if there's enough information to do so. And I think that's something we all have to be open to. I think we have a huge issue with admitting when we're wrong, because it's almost like, oh, you must be an idiot if you admit you're wrong, you know. So we can never be wrong, so we always have to admit that we're right, and if we're not right, we have to argue it until the end of time, you know. So I think those are all things that are really important. What's your opinion on the Montessori schools, you know, because that's something I've been kind of looking into a little bit too, because for the future, my kids are too young at the moment, but you know, that type of philosophy of you know, not really focusing on testing or anything like that, but kind of focusing on imagination and you know, look at what their passions are and kind of highlight those things and help them kind of explore those things they enjoy.
Well, I think it's a step up certainly from the Prussian education system that is exhibited through public and many private schools. I think that schooling in general is a set of methodologies to make people think alike. And in some ways, that's a good thing. Like, you know, we see a fire and we should all be thinking, where are the exits? Where's the fire extinguisher? Who's calling the fire department? We should have a kind of a uniform reaction across certain things that prevent us from having calamity and catastrophe in our lives, right? That's not such a bad thing to think alike on. Also, the need for freedom and reason. These are good things to think alike on. But most of what you need to learn needs to be done through education, which can't and doesn't happen in schools, because schooling is very much the opposite. It's the antithesis to asking questions for yourself and learning how to find those answers for yourself, which is basically what you have to do for, you know, the rest of your life to be self-reliant and have real self-esteem and self-confidence. Otherwise, you're going to be standing around always waiting to be told what to learn, what the answers are, without asking the questions yourself. You're denying yourself of the essence of an educational experience. You know, I do have a son now. He's 11 months old. I'm not looking to send him. Yeah, thank you. He was born last January. And we had some difficulties when we started out, but it's been an amazing year. And it's amazing to see someone learn without language yet, just from cause and effect. And I think this is a layer that a lot of people get separated from, because there's so much done through language that you forget about the basic cause and effect that is innate to human beings. So I'm not necessarily trying to get him schooled so he can get a job, but I would like him to be educated, to be autodidactic, to maybe at least explore the option of starting his own business instead of working for somebody else. But there's a time and place maybe for all these things, and it's not either or. It could be also and, you know, knowing that you could have the responsibility to run your own business and to meet a certain set of needs or provide a service to people in your vicinity on this planet. Like, that's a powerful thing. But if you don't want to do that and you think you might be happier working for someone else, that's fine too. But at least you know that there are options and that you can engage your choice and you can engage your free will and you can engage your right to think or not to think. But right now we're headed on a path in the geopolitical environment where they're just going to make the rules on whether or not you can think or not to think, or what thoughts you can have. And they're not concerned with whether or not you know how to think. They're every bit concerned with what you think. And they will surveil you and they'll read your mail and, you know, take away your ability to encrypt and all these other things that come along the way as a purpose of control. And punishment and control aren't that far apart. When any time the state, for instance, wants to take and control you, they take away your freedom. So it shows that if people are inclined to want to keep their freedom, they don't break these arbitrary rules, a lot of times arbitrary rules made by the state, which comes back to the nature of the philosophical arguments of authority. The argumentation that me and my friends can sign a piece of paper and now hold you responsible for things that you didn't agree to, weren't party to, and it's not even local to you, because the world is more and more being ruled in a non-local manner. And without local accountability, that's a form of slavery. And I think at the heart of everyone who's ever studied the notion or the topic or the agenda of the New World Order, which is a very real geopolitical animal that exists, it's a real predator against freedom, people don't get that that whole agenda is just about non-local accountability, because without local accountability, how can you resist? Who can resist? You know, it's gone from somewhere where you can go over and knock on the guy's door and have a conversation to now it's a non-local, non-governmental element that has control over your ability to communicate on the internet or your ability to publish news or podcasts or any of these other things that are necessary, because the printing press is definitely, you know, part of the strategy for individual liberty. And it's something that people who love freedom need and people who want to be tyrants hate.
And how many, if we're on an island, how many of these ridiculous laws and rules would we actually, if it was just like a handful of us, you know, the world ended, we're stuck on an island. You know, if me and you were having a cigar in some building that we, you know, or some shelter that we built, would they be like, hey, remember, you can't smoke indoors? You know, would anybody give a shit? You know, it's like so many of these things, like if we lived in smaller communities, we wouldn't be enforced because we just wouldn't care. You know, we wouldn't care as long as they weren't getting in the way of somebody, like we said before, getting away of somebody else's happiness or somebody else's ability to live their lives. So I think, you know, it's this idea, this theme of freedoms and stuff like that. You know, it's you know, I've been trying to get Adam Kokesh on the show for a little bit. We've been back and forth, and then I think our schedules collided, and then and I haven't been able to contact him since. But you know, obviously he's very much, you know, outspoken about that, and you know, I want to have him on to talk about that whole idea of freedom. What is freedom? You know, and it just, I think it seems like a word that we use all the time. We hear it all the time, but people don't necessarily understand how we lack it.
Well, you could define it. You could define it by its opposite, because that's the easiest way. It's the absence of slavery.
Yeah.
So if you're not experiencing freedom, you are being controlled. Your means of living, your means of shelter, your means of protection from predators, all these things are being controlled artificially, not by your free will. You are not voluntarily participating in that. And if so, it's because you don't know all the facts. That's called being nescient. That's not necessarily an agreement. So what are we talking about? Freedom. To be free of having my production plundered. To be free of having my life and my ability to exist on this planet threatened. Like, there's enough things in nature aside from the human social element, right? But when you look at the greatest cause of death for human beings in the last 100 years, it's democide. It's death by government. And people who don't get that, they're like, they're missing out on this whole concept of something called statism, which is worshiping an authority that has no right to be an authority to you. This is something I'm sure Kokesh will talk about for this entire interview. The whole idea that you own your own body, which isn't a recent idea, but it's still seeking to be popularized, isn't it? You know, these are the types of ideas that were around when America was being formed. And these are the types of ideas that were purposely taken out of the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, so that some people had more rights than other people, even though we're all people, right? So these ideas were innate to those conversations at the beginning, but then people who had property interests in the way of human capital said, we can't have that, we can't destroy this, we can't do this, we can't shut this down yet. And that's where the whole struggle of abolition was waged and, you know, came to pass like over 100 and some years. From start to finish, and you could argue it's not finished yet, and I would say, yeah, absolutely. Until everyone on the planet has a notion of what freedom is so they can notice when they don't have it, you're going to have what we have here, which is influxes and you know, increases and decreases of slavery in our country, in other countries, depending on how many people are actually aware of the rights that they have as innate human beings on the planet, as opposed to rights for this group because of their religion or rights to this group because of their skin color. Like, all these other divisions are just that. They're artificial words used to divide and conquer people away from our common needs. And if you recognize you have common needs and someone else has common needs, why would you deny them? If you think you have the right to water, why would you not deny them the right to water? If you think you have the right to food and the right to not be accosted in an intellectual or physical manner, then shouldn't they have that right too? And if so, why not? And what reason would you be using? And when you get down to it, a lot of those people won't have a reason. They won't have a chain of reasoning attached to that decision. It'll be something where they're intellectually bankrupt and now they want to fight, because that's where violence picks up, where people no longer have the intellectual capacity for debate and they want it anyway, then they start a fight, or they say you're a racist, or that's Hitler, or whatever, you know, they use as the absence of thinking to stop the conversation instead of saying, what are we really upset about? Are we really being divided and conquered, or do these legitimate problems exist where they'll never get along? And when you look into it, into the history, it seems that certain groups profit from pitting other groups off against each other, because at least the, whichever one's standing has now been gratefully depleted and is easily taken out. It's a strategy of warfare, which has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I'm not saying we can do anything to prevent it from going on. I'm just saying knowing it has existed allows us to react and respond differently than if we didn't know at all. And that's kind of the value that knowledge has to human beings in this ongoing saga of survival, but to not survive at all costs. You don't want to survive and lose your human beingness. It's for us all to just, you know, become uncivilized and act like animals and prey on each other, even though we should be trusting each other and have this capacity for working together. We just throw that away, because destruction is always easier than creation. And I think destruction and violence is the lowest common denominator. And that creativity and reason is living up to the highest potential that human beings have. And so I would rather, you know, trend toward that and remind people that they do have this choice available to them, or they can continue to be psychologically and emotionally manipulated by the status quo authorities in power. But at least knowing there's at least those two sides to it, and you can get into even more nuances, gives you choice. It returns your choice, and that is essentially enabling people to free themselves. And that's the difference between freedom and slavery.
There's always a pause after you're done talking, because my brain's trying to consume everything you just said. Yeah, no, you broke it down beautifully. I think that, you know, it's just everything I say after what you said is going to sound really dumb.
Never, dude, because we're just having a conversation. And we are having the thoughtfulness to preserve this conversation in such a way that other people can observe it at a later time who weren't co-located with us, you know? And I think that's just using media to our advantage. We're talking about useful concepts that pertain to individual liberty. So essentially that should have like one of the widest audiences that's ever been available. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
If people's priorities are in the right place, in the freedom place.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting about this conversation is that I think people are turned off by the idea of, okay, I'm a libertarian, or I'm a, you know, these isms, you know, like these
labels. Yeah, as soon as you start to label yourself, you're negating some of your other best aspects.
Exactly. And you know, you talked about dogmas. I mean, all these things also have dogmas, you know, and I think when we just talk about the ideas in general, and people can kind of just dissect the ideas and not have to worry about the label that's attached to it. You know, it's, you know, I've said on this podcast, you know, like a lot of these isms, that if there's one that you don't like, I bet you I could find something that's a idea that's attached to it and not tell you it's attached. And you might agree with that idea if I don't tell you it's attached to that ism that you already determined that you don't like, you know? So I think that's really important, you know, and like I said before, we're emotional creatures. We don't ever know why somebody might disagree with you. You know, I've had disagreements with people where you think, okay, this person seems a pretty logical person until we talked about this. All of a sudden they're over the top and they're not listening and they're not trying to share ideas or make points or just trying to win. And you find out more about them and you find out, oh, maybe their dad was, you know, had this type of philosophy that kind of, you know, molded to his philosophy, or maybe, you know, this happened in their life or that happened in their life. So I think even, you know, with ourselves, it's important to dissect why we like things, why we don't like things, why we do things, why we don't do things. And realize that, you know, sometimes, you know, we aren't as open-minded and logical thinking as we think we are, you know. So it's when we can just share ideas and not put any isms and not have any conflict with it, I think it's a very productive thing.
Well, there's that the phrase out there now is triggered. People are triggered by not their logic and reason reactions. They're triggered by the emotional reactions that are coming many times from words. And that shows that those people have no sense of being responsible for their own thoughts, and that they're not responsible for other people's thoughts. And if you confuse that, then all of a sudden people are getting emotionally triggered. But you can only be emotionally triggered if you're kind of ignorant or nescient about what emotions actually are. emotions are essentially how we feel about what we think. And if you're having negative emotions, then it might be a good idea to improve the quality of your thoughts by learning either various different sides instead of just one side of the matter, or learning into a space where you don't know anything, and just learning to grow in the light direction. Follow the pattern of natural curiosity, observing that which exists through your five senses, gaining the knowledge and vernacular and definitions for the words that describe those things that actually exist, learning how to connect them together and remove the contradictions, and then being able to communicate what you've learned to other people in a creative way. That's how you would improve the quality of your thoughts, and that will then, therefore, improve how you feel. Because now you have a better understanding. You have the words to describe the things you're encountering. You have a way to reflect it back into the world such that someone else can reflect it back and you can continue learning. So it's the whole process of that which makes us human itself is this power to think or not to think, to put space in between our stimulus and reactions that other animals on this planet do not have. And that's how they're so easily controlled or trained. You know, I think it was a Skinner experiment where he took pigeons and he put them in a box and they turned this dial that had words on it and it would turn right or turn left depending on the words, but they were just using an advanced form of reward. So they can make animals that would appear to you as a human being they can read. How'd they teach that pigeon to read? Well, no, it's just they're using these tricks. And the way that we are different from those animals, if we're going to be different, see, they want to take out the thinking between stimulus and response because it makes individuals more into that schooled collective mentality where people are easier to control. It is very hard to control a bunch of individuals who are all thinking for themselves. It's hard to predict what they're going to do, and therefore it's hard to control them. They're all going to seek to escape in a variety of ways. Whereas schooling, it's like, oh, the only way you can escape is to get a good job and make a lot of – there's these, you know, predetermined escape routes that they manage the whole way. So it gets back to, you know, if you recognize it, that you're trying to, you know, make money to buy things, to fill up your self-confidence and self-esteem, to make people like you, realize that there are other ways that are more substantial and rewarding and long-living and are going to lead to happiness quicker, but they're not going to be advertised to you by these other people who want to make money from you being a slave or capitulative to their agenda. And so that's a lesson that I had to learn for myself. I thought it's kind of unfair we're not taught these lessons in school or through the media or even at the place of work unless you're on the wrong end of the consequences, and that I could, you know, give up and go back to that lifestyle and keep being abused by it, or I could take what I learned and try to let other people free themselves and do likewise.
Yeah, that pigeon thing, it's really interesting. And I think actually you might have had a clip of it in State of Mind, but it's interesting because it kind of, it's a perfect example of our issue with public schools and the way we teach kids or try to provoke intelligence. It's a pigeon can look like it knows how to read. You're absolutely right. You know, it sees a word and it has reaction because of that word, but it doesn't know what the word is. It doesn't know what the word means. And that's kind of, you know, us focusing on testing and, you know, it's you memorize this answer because it's going to be on the test. And then after the test, you completely forget any of the things that you memorized because it wasn't important and there was no reason to memorize it besides passing that test. So you're not really teaching thinking or you know, you're not really teaching intelligence or provoking intelligence. You're just, it's memorization. It's memorizing a thing, you know, a color or a set of letters together, and not actually figuring out what it means or why or you know, all those things. So yeah, I think it's a perfect example because that's kind of what they do in school. You know, when I was in high school, it was the same thing. It was, you know, I memorized enough that I needed to memorize to pass the test. And once I passed the test, all the information kind of just got deleted from my mind, from my memory bank.
Well, and it's kind of the opposite of learning, because learning is like connecting the step by step. Oh, here's why it leads to this and why it leads to this. And you know, so they are complementary in some cases where your volition is not being violated, but in other cases where it's like you just have to memorize this to pass this test and you're never going to have context for how you'd use that calculus in real life or whatever it might be. You know, those formulae, those lists of various words and syllables that make different sounds. It's like if it doesn't have contextual meaning, it's kind of meaningless. That's kind of what meaning is. And so when you were referring to the pigeon clip, we might have used something in State of Mind for a B-roll, but I do remember – I think it was 2010, I did a pilot for a series called What You've Been Missing, or WYBM, is the other way to search it on YouTube. And I think it was the opening scene where I had a TV, like a Skinner box, an electronic Skinner box, showing the experiments of Skinner in the case of these pigeons who could read. And then I made a visual metaphor where I throw the TV and break it to try to break that conditioning. But this idea that standardized testing in schools produces responsible, self-reliant people with, you know, good self-esteem, self-confidence because they have a knowledge of this world. It does anything but that. I think the real test is how fast can you get to happiness and maintain or increase your level of happiness without violating the will or volition of other individuals? That's the real test. Because the people who are really happy aren't happy because they're keeping other people enslaved on the other end. I would argue that a poor person who doesn't have slaves is essentially happier than a rich person who does have slaves. When you get down to the actual meaning of life and the things that are really valuable, they're not usually being purchased with money. Yes, food and shelter and these things, you need some money to get along. But the really meaningful things, the interactions with your friends and family, the things that are intrinsic to being human beings, because aside from our physical nature and our presence here, there is the emotional and intellectual capacities of being a human. Right? And those two things coalesce in this kind of magical experience. And I say magical because we can't yet explain it using words yet, right? That we're always learning about. And you made this comment earlier about like being afraid to be wrong. It's like you have to lose that fear to learn anything, because I'm wrong several times a day. But those are what actually leads into meaningful knowledge. You know, the experience. It's like, oh, you're trying to do something. You might do it wrong the first couple times. You need to read the directions. You might need to learn a few new words. You might challenge your intellectual capacity. But guess what? You have the potential to grow and to learn that thing, whether it's repairing something on your house or your automobile or a relationship with somebody. It's like we have these innate, like just infinite capacities that are always being whittled down by our priorities and then our actions. And a lot of times, if we don't do the thinking for ourselves, we're going to end up in these meaningless activities that people, you know, find to be like what they call everyday life. Like getting up early, going to work, their kids go to school, they come home, they're too tired to do anything meaningful, their kids are drained because they've been getting controlled all day, and now they got homework and these sorts of things. And it's like, life's been going on for a long time, and this seems like a really crappy way to run things, and yet everyone is just so trying to keep up with the Joneses and hip, you know, trying to be hip and trendy without learning about things like conspicuous consumption and premature obsolescence and these other psychological drivers that have been used to control the actions of human beings now for 100 years plus. Like, they've been codified for that long, and they were used a long time before that, before someone said, hey, wait a minute. You know, if we make things not to last that long, people would have to buy things more often, right? But after having that happen so much in history, someone's came along and they're like, hey, you know, we'll call that premature obsolescence. Or, you know, conspicuous consumption, the work of Thorsten Veblen in the late 1800s, early 1900s, saying, hey, if we don't give people the skills and knowledge and the learning abilities to be self-reliant, then we can switch them over to having to earn money to buy things to make themselves feel good and to look good to others and be attractive. Right? They basically externalize the things that should be internalized. And, you know, I realize it had to happen for us to get this far, but now that we can notice it, we could stop that, you know? Not saying you have to. I'm just saying people have the choice if they're given the perspectives that are missing.
Yeah, but you're right. Being wrong is a huge issue because I think a lot of times trying to be right or attempting not to be wrong becomes the focus of a conversation instead of focusing on the ideas. And you know, maybe it's ego, you know, it could be a lot of different things, but I think we can't, you know, we have to get over this idea that it, you know, we're all wrong. I mean, I'm wrong, you say you're wrong once in a while. I mean, I'm wrong
all the time.
I'm wrong
every day. I'm wrong about something, several things usually. If not, I'm not doing a very good job to discover more than I knew the day before.
Oh,
I look at it. It's like, yeah. Oh, you think you know something about this historic event? Go out and read one of the 100 books on that event. I bet you just learned something you didn't know. I bet you just brought something you thought you knew into question, right? So I think it was Parmenides, the Greek philosopher, who said, you know, everything is change. Everything is moving through its cycle of life and death on this planet. And that's what, you know, time and all these other things that come along with them. I'm pretty sure that was Parmenides. So to come up to today and say, oh, I know everything and everything I know is accurate and it's never going to change, is to deny like the whole circle of life and what's actually going on and what you're participating in. I think that's, you know, one of the goals. You can call that ego, to want to know what you're participating in and what you're giving your action for. But I just call that like part of reality. you know, being conscious.
Yeah, and I think another thing is we can learn a lot from our kids. You know, you see a lot of kids who love their parents and they grew up in a poor environment, or they grew up, you know, their parents didn't have a lot or whatever. It's, you know, the things that made that child happy was the parents being around. It was community. It was attention. It was interaction. And as we get older, marketing, you know, and this goes back to the work of Edward Bernays, understanding how to pull at our desires and temptations and convincing us that it's these material things that will bring us happiness. And then our endless search for happiness in those material things, which is never ending. You know, we have to realize that similar to the children, we're the same way. Like the things that make us happy are the simple things. It's the having a cigar with your friends. It's having community, conversation, laughing. When you look back at life, those are the things you're going to remember. You're not going to remember, you know, how much money you made or any of that other stuff. And you know, sometimes, you know, you drive by a really nice house and you're with friends or whoever that, oh, you know, look at that house, and they're envious of it. And I'm just like,
yeah,
you know,
at what cost?
Exactly. And that's what I was going to get to. You know, at what cost? I have friends that, you know, I know a cop, a good friend of mine, a police officer who makes six figures because of all the details he works. And I always make fun of him, like, hey, I'm like, your wife won't even recognize you if you're not in a vest, a detail vest, because you're never home. You know, you're never home. Your kids aren't going to be there. And yeah, you got a beautiful house for your kids, but your kids would rather have you at their game when they're playing, or have you have a little bit of energy when you're actually home, so you could actually interact with them and ask them about their day and all that stuff. And you know, that's much more important for me. You know, because we have a small family business, I could choose to work more than I do, but I like having you know, like
quality
I always say, you can make more money. You can't make more time. You know, those weekends that I have with my kids, I mean, my son's super attached to me because, you know, during the winter time, because work slows down and I'm home a lot more, and he doesn't give a shit how big our house is. He doesn't give a shit the toys I buy him. He's attached to me because I'm around and I play with him, and we laugh.
Teaching him how the world works.
Exactly. You know, so I think, you know, we can learn from our kids and being around kids. You'd see what makes them happy. When you could buy them the most expensive toy, but when they're adults, the things that they're going to talk about is you being there at their game when they scored that goal, or you know, or you throwing a ball in the backyard with them. It didn't matter if that backyard was a big backyard or a small backyard. You know, it was just the fact that you were there and you're spending time with them. And I think that as we get older, little by little, marketing and you know, like that good documentary Corporation, the Corporation, the Canadian documentary, which really focused on the psychology that goes into getting us to want things and buy things and whatnot. I think we end up being convinced that those are the things that actually bring us happiness. But if we look at kids before the programming, they you know, they kind of have it figured out. You know, the things that make them happy is just community and time and being around one another. And you know, I think those are all really important things. And what's your opinion on psychedelics? You know, when you talk about, you know, not being brainwashed, you're looking at things from outside the box, and you know, there's a lot of great minds, you know, that came out of the 60s era who messed around with psychedelics, and some people, of course, you have the opinion of, you know, it was meant to dumb down society or people, and some people believe it was a dangerous tool because it was harder to brainwash somebody when you know, all the anti-war people who the protesters and the hippies who were anti-war, because they didn't, you know, personally it seems like they didn't fall for the war propaganda, because maybe they did have the psychedelics that made them not want to or not fall for the propaganda on TV or whatever reasons they were giving the public on why they were going to war. I mean, do you think that it's a good tool, or is it a bad tool? Is it something you haven't really thought about at all?
Well, I've thought about it. I've done more than think about it. I've experimented.
Really?
I've generated my own thoughts on it. No. So before I address that, because that's a serious question, but where you started off was the use of parents' time, whether going off and working overtime, working in the cubicle and coming home so you can have more money, bigger house, what have you, versus actually spending time and attention teaching this young person how to acclimate to this world, and, you know, about the perils and the different things that you can do if you avoid these perils successfully to lead to happiness, right? So, like, picture, you know, somebody going to a psychiatrist and they're going there and they're getting treatment. Is that person saying, my parents, you know, spent so much time at work and ignored me and put me in, you know, the YMCA in the morning. And then I was at school all day, and then I had babysitters when I came home, and I hardly ever saw them. Is that the person who's in therapy, or the person who said, yeah, I had a great time. I hung out with my parents. We traveled. We learned about new things. They came to all my baseball, soccer, football, ice hockey games, what have you. You know, those aren't the people who are going for therapy, because they don't have that aspect missing, where they're still seeking attention and approval and knowledge that they should have gotten while they were children. And that's kind of where, you know, psychological analysts and psychiatrists have made all their money. They're feeding on a whole demographic of people who didn't get the proper attention they needed or the proper knowledge to be self-reliant and have real self-esteem. And they sense that something's missing, and they think, if I go and make a bunch of money and pay this other person to ask me questions about myself while they sit there and take notes, and I'll get that thing back. Like, that's a cruel joke being played on people. In most circumstances, that's what I see going on. Instead of these people actually going and filling that need, they're just paying this other person who's supposed to be the authority and fix them, right? So there's that aspect. And what you're describing, that dichotomy, that is like the choice to either spend time, homeschool your kids, have a good relationship that's healthy because you're learning every day, you're passing on what you've learned to them, and that's kind of like the continuity of life, versus go off, help somebody else achieve their dream, make a percentage of that's pretty nominal, always be struggling, always be in this hamster wheel, and they get all your extra energy, they get all your tax money, what have you, from all your hard work, plundering your production. That doesn't lead to like good mental health for the parents, so it can't really be passed down to the children, because the parents are always anxious and in living in a world of scarcity where they have to take psychotropic pharmaceutical drugs that don't really have any good consequences except numbing out life as a way to just get through their life. Whereas I think that traditionally, to get into the psychedelic aspect, the mind-expanding aspect, that is part of nature, that has been part of cultures for thousands of years. It was a relationship between the individual, the specific, and the environment of this earth as a whole, or the generality. And the relationship was through the mind of the human being. So there is that really rich, innate, natural relationship that is there. But if you have some group of human beings and say, yeah, we notice this thing exists in nature, how can we control that to profit and plunder other people's productions? Then you have things like organized religion, where they swap out the actual psychedelic aspect and they say, here's a placebo. You can get, here's some juice and a cracker, and you're going to have the same psychedelic experience. You're going to have a communication union with the largerness of this creation, but you're going to do it through us. And oh, by the way, you know, here's some confession for you. Come tell us the things that we're going to make these rules. Like, there's all this middleman nature to it that is like an artificial construct of human beings. So to get to answer your question, I think that when human beings partake in psychedelics wittingly of their own free will in a mindset of seeking to expand their mind and learn more about the details of this planet and in life itself, I think that can be healthy if it's done in a constructive way that's non-abusive. However, I also see the history of some secret societies over time that have used psychedelics to control people. It's the same way that critical thinking, like the methods of critical thinking, if you're not using them, they're always being used against you, like you've said, through propaganda, public relations, all these different various experiments to control human behavior that we've mentioned, conspicuous consumption, premature adolescence, extended adolescence and premature obsolescence. If you can't tell the difference between a quality product that'll last a long time made with quality materials and craftsmanship versus something that was cheaply put together to imitate that product in a much cheaper way to feed profits, if you can't tell that difference, then that's losing the game. You're going to be taken advantage of. All that learning that has been accumulated, all that knowledge that's been accumulated through history is going to be used against you. However, if you learn how to learn anything for yourself and you start building up a substantial library of self-knowledge and experience to be able to avoid those other circumstances where it can be used against you, now you're able to resist. You might even be able to exist in a way that outweighs the amount of resistance. Now you're making forward progress. That's meaningful progress because you're leading yourself toward freedom. You're not leading yourself to take other people's freedom away as a measure to do that. And that, to me, is what causes happiness. When you can meet your needs, exceed your needs, exceed your expectations without taking away somebody else's freedom as a process of doing that, that's where happiness is. I can tell you where it is on the map, and I can kind of give you some methods on how to get there, but everyone's journey to that place is going to be a little bit different because of where you're starting and where you've been already and how you have to go about getting there. But I think that psychedelics, if used constructively, can play a role in each individual making those discernments, doing the comparison and contrast, collecting the raw data and experience, in sensory perception, also attaching the words and the concepts to it. It can be a great facilitator. But you also have to know that it can also be used to control people. It has been used through history to adversely influence people under control. So without knowing like the lightness and the darkness of the subject, you are leaving yourself open from either side to have a learning experience. That's the only difference. Like how much learning do you want to do, and how much would you like to know before you go into it?
So how many pot cookies have you had?
None.
Have you messed around with psychedelics? Have you messed around with what specifically, or is it something you'd rather not talk about?
Well, I didn't experience any type of psychedelics while I was in high school. So going through high school, I was a straight A student. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke any cannabis. I didn't have certainly any exposure to anything but those things. Those were the things that were like on the social radar. You knew friends that they went out and got drunk. I knew friends that maybe smoked a little weed, and I didn't really cross those paths until I got into college and I started being a little bit more autonomous. And I had roommates and friends that were smoking and partaking in cannabis. And I said, oh, what's that all about? You know, they seem to always be having a good time. Seems to be very little downside historically to that, except for the prohibition aspect of it. So I've had experiences on cannabis. And as far as psychedelics, I mean, there's availability of that in earlier parts of my life as well. And so it was a similar sort of path. If you see somebody having some psychedelic mushrooms and they seem to be having a good time, and you're out in nature and you can have natural experiences where you're not under somebody else's control or becoming part of some group that you don't want to be associated with, hey, those seem like fun, good times, you know? If you were in a situation where you were being mandated to take it, like some sort of institution, like Clockwork Orange. That whole experiment, I believe, that is reflected in that writing is because Ken Kesey was working in some mental institution while he was taking LSD. And he's like, wow, what a trippy juxtaposition. And that turns into not a Clockwork Orange, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Clockwork Orange is a separate set of literature that was made into a movie with similar aspects. So Altered States is another film where it's like you've got one guy in a system who voluntarily partakes in some experiments that the system really doesn't want to dabble with, and then they add in some fictional, you know, mumbo jumbo at the end. But there's some, you know, interesting films out there if you don't want to jump in without looking at these things, or there's a lot of interesting books on these topics from people who have not just opined but have done it through first person experiences. And I think it's one of the most interesting and fascinating aspects of human beingness that is so little talked about out there. So, there's good experiences to be had. It's just like anything else. If you want to have a good experience in a car, learn the aspects of the car, how it works, how, you know, accidents happen, how to avoid those accidents, and how to go about driving around, without running into other people and damaging their freedom or their property.
Yeah, that's I've talked to a lot of interesting, and I've had actually Dennis McKenna on, who the brother of Terrence McKenna, and he's talked about, well, he's a part of the Hefner Institute. He's also a really good documentary that hits on the topic is Neurons to Nirvana, which looks at all the medical properties of a lot of these things like MDMA and
now,
all these.
Yeah, MDMA, which used to be called ecstasy, which now is a chemical derivative or cousin of Molly, I believe, right? So it's a type of substance that brings on. Molly.
Isn't it just a street name? Like Molly's.
Yeah, but I thought there was a chemical composition difference whether it includes an amphetamine, because most of the time, like real MDMA, if memory serves, you can't take alcohol with it because it'll cause you physical problems. But most ecstasy or MDMA that's on the street is cut with amphetamines.
Yes.
So Molly is either a derivative that's the same thing as MDMA, or it's something that's cut with amphetamines, or it can be both. Maybe it's just a street slang name and doesn't pertain to the actual molecule composition. But, you know, that's being used for PTSD and all sorts of other medical applications out there. So after it's popularized in the underground and raves and other places where, for a short term period, it does create an interesting experience. But you also have to be aware of the downside or the coming down from that experience and be able to make a happy medium with it and not abuse it. Just like a lot of other things, it's useful to not overindulge in those types of experiences or substances, but it's also a healthy thing to maybe be familiar with the fact that those experiences exist. So you can at least give yourself choice if that's something you want to explore. The same thing with like psilocybin or psychedelic mushrooms or LSD or any of these other substances that create introspective experiences, but they can also be achieved without the use of external compounds or cocktails, things like the sensory deprivation tank, where you're just like in a, you know, several hundred gallons of salt water floating in darkness, and then your mind, in the absence of stimuli, starts to do the same thing. So whether, you know, it's a low grade psychotropic or psychoactive experience, like, smoking THC or CBDs through marijuana or cannabis, some of the other experiences like DMT or psychedelic mushrooms or LSD, or even, you know, in between there is probably Molly or MDMA, as far as the casuality of the experiences. Like, you might be able to smoke a joint and do most regular things. You take some ecstasy, it's going to be limited to the things that you can do. And then if you take a heavier psychedelic like psilocybin or especially DMT, you're going to have to plan your actions and activities very carefully. You might even be non-participatory in your body for a few moments. Because you can have an out-of-body experience by taking a large dose of psychedelic mushrooms, as much as you could have a shorter time smoking DMT, or you can go for the 8-hour experience of ayahuasca, which is a DMT experience that's like stretched out into multiple hours. I've studied all these things. I have books on all the substances that I've just mentioned. I don't think any of those substances cause long-term addictions unless your addiction is to life itself, you know? And even that, it can deal with some of those ego attachment experiences for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's really interesting about all those things is the idea of finding a way of looking at your life or looking at yourself without all the bullshit filters, you know, all the things that we do. You know, we always try to convince ourselves that we're, you know, we judge others much more harshly than we judge ourselves. We always try to convince ourselves we're better friends than people are to us. So we're a better husband than maybe my wife is a wife. You know, all these things where
this is an age-old problem, and this is what Dickens is showing in A Christmas Carol. You know, Scrooge is so mushrooms back. Historically, were popularized among the ruling classes and witnessed by the slave classes. So there's some, you know, entrees into early Christianity and the practice of taking what their Roman rulers were doing and making it more of an underground religion. It starts this idea of freedom, which ties into the Phrygian cap, which is a symbol of the Liberty cap, which is also today a symbol of psychedelic mushrooms. So there's like that aspect. But the Dickens experience is an out-of-body experience where he says, where have I been? Where am I right now? Where am I going? And he changes his actions. It's a complete metaphor of the psychedelic experience and the fact that there is a tie between psychedelic mushrooms and the Christmas holiday and the practices before Christ was even born, right? So there is this layering of the Christmas holiday and this time of reflection. And guess what? If people did regularly partake in a voluntary way so that they had these times of reflection, people would be a lot nicer to each other. They'd be a lot more appreciative of what they have, right? Because even, you know, in my experience, the so-called worst trips, the most fear-evoking realizations you make through that introspection turn out to be, you know, important life experiences and lessons that teach you humility and compassion and empathy and all things that are good for the perpetuation of the human race to live with freedom and liberty, as opposed to existing in a state of slavery where you're being subject to a whole bunch of rules and regulations that you never had any input to and wouldn't agree to if you did. So there is this innate connection through human history between the use of psychedelics and the history of individual liberty and freedom. And there's a strong connection back in the history and culture of India. And they have this this way of looking at it called Swaraj, which means self-rulership. Well, self-rulership just doesn't happen out of nowhere. It comes out of learning lessons of life such that you can now be your own boss, be in control of your own life, and you don't need to have an external government to tell you that all the crops you just grew belong to the state, and you and your family are going to starve regardless of how much you produce. You're going to be plundered just because these people have a belief that that's the ruling authority and not logic and reason, right? So all of these things, and I guess the thing I'll say about psychedelics is, you know, it's something that I think, I mean, I was kind of shocked. I'm like, how could this exist and no one's mentioned it to me up until this point, you know? You just find out kind of randomly and like an unplanned for way. You know, you just happen to be around some people one time that are having that experience and you're like, what are they doing, you know? As opposed to knowing about it at a young age, so I could have read up on it more and maybe had some more history under my belt. But, you know, luckily, if you have your wits about you and you're a good person at heart, it usually works out pretty good.
Yeah. I think that's why, you know, certain people like Graham Hancock and other people have kind of made, and Rick Dublin from MAPS, and I think they're really changing the perspective, that people's opinions on psychedelics, that it's not just the get high and listen to a Pink Floyd album, but it's
Starter. That's a starter, but then later you learn that, you know, it can be, you know, a treatment, again, psychedelic mushrooms, treatments for PTSD, treatments for cancer anxiety. Like, if you have something that's going to kill you and the fear of it killing you is actually going to make it worse and ruin the rest of your life that you have living, and you can take something, whether it's MDMA or psychedelic mushrooms, in a setting that's comfortable to you and actually learn to outthink your fear, like, that's what we have seeded this planet, not me and you, but we as humanity have seeded this planet now. Like the governments that we are live subjugated to have created all these nuclear weapons that are all over the place. And fear is what's going to trigger those things off into action at some point, because that's their destiny unless we dismantle them and figure out how to use that fuel for something else, not to pollute ourselves or poison or toxify the whole planet with it. Right? Like, it's already kind of a complex problem. Let's not make it more complex by, you know, setting all those things in action. And if they're all going to be triggered by fear, then what do we need? We need a process to take us from fear to knowledge, from fear to confidence. That's learning. That's using your five senses, examining that which exists, start removing the contradictions and actually getting to a point where you can communicate this cogently to another human being such that they don't have to panic and have an emotional reaction because their thoughts are all gummed up around the same thing. That's where we can use communication to actually elongate the human species, whereas through the panic and fear and emotion mode, they're going to end up using, like the other day, there was a social media mishap where it was like Pakistan misunderstood, I don't know what if it was Israel or Iran or somebody, but it almost started like a nuclear war, and now they want to use that as precedent for, oh, we need more controls. How about we teach people to stop believing things that aren't true? Oh, because that might end some of the artificial authorities that are so powerful on this planet that created nuclear war and weapons in the first place. Because if you go back to the original history, the artifacts that exist at this current time and have been preserved thus far, not counting that which has been destroyed, what you find out is the design for the nuclear bombs that were used in World War II to end it, to bring the Japanese. Again, we talked about Pearl Harbor earlier and how that was contrived. Guess what? We didn't develop nuclear weapons to use on Germany or Japan. They were conceptualized and started to be developed before that war even started. And then they were just used as the excuse for everyone to say, well, I don't want to do this. I don't want to mine this uranium and enrich it and do all these things at the Tennessee Valley Authority and all the things that were going on at Los Alamos. A lot of those scientists and physicists were against the creation and use of that weapon, but they're just doing their job. They're just being patriotic. They were just following orders. And when they set aside their consciousness, when they set aside their conscience and start creating weapons of mass destruction, that even after Europe was done, because the first excuse was, we have to do it because the Nazis are going to build those bombs, and if we don't build them first, they're going to win the war. Well, guess what? When VE Day, when victory over Europe came, the scientists were like, hey, let's stop building this bomb now. We don't need it. We're not going to need it against the Japanese. I said, no, you're going to still need it because, you know, otherwise we're going to lose thousands more servicemen's lives, and you guys have to use these bombs to stop the war, even though it was being all puppeteered by a bunch of bankers and people who supported the existing empire, which was collapsing under its own weight and wanted to continue that way of enslaving and colonizing the planet, right? So there's all these other nuances that people are never going to get to because they think, oh, you know, they're of one political party and these other people are of a different political party and never the twain shall meet. It's like, no, we all have to step back and look at the things we have in common as human beings and say, what exists on this planet that we would build these weapons of mass destruction? And then they just didn't build one or two that they used to end a war. They set up a system so once they created it, they could build thousands. and they could leak the plans to other countries. And now they could have other countries that have these bombs, and that ups the strategy of tension. And guess what? A strategy of tension is not used to liberate, educate, and make sure that people are free. It's very much used to control people, control their actions, control their predictable emotional reactions to that which goes on. And then if you have a system of media and news in a country or around the world that is no longer reflecting reality, but putting out talking points all through all these different outlets that are saying the same thing, be very scared of these people. Don't be scared of these people. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. We should use the chemical weapons on these people, but we shouldn't use them on these people. Like, it's a whole justification based on bullshit, but no one has a bullshit detector anymore. And so I like to think that's kind of what I do in my work, is teach people how to build their own bullshit detectors. Decide. You don't have to believe anything I've said through this whole interview, but take some of the things I've said and go out and start looking for yourself. Because that's where you're going to find meaning. That's where you're going to find your meaningful connection to this reality, because either you've been given the right script and you know what's going on already, or you're about to learn for yourself in a way that I can't tell you. That's also relating back to the psychedelic experience. It's something that you can only have for yourself, and no matter what words you want to hang on it, you can't like pass it to somebody else, but you can encourage somebody else to figure out for themselves that which you've experienced. And they'll have their own unique experience. And the fact that we all have unique experiences means that we have much in common, and yet we're all unique individuals looking at everything by physical definition from different perspectives. Like if I'm sitting in my chair and you're sitting in your chair, you can't see through my perspective because you couldn't sit physically in the same place at the same time under the same circumstances. That's the nature of causality, which goes back to the reason we actually need to learn these things, to learn how to have these old world skills, or at least an appreciation of what it takes to put food on our table, a roof over our heads, to control our climate such that we don't freeze or burn up from the heat or the cold, and to begin to have empathy with people on the other side of the world that might not look like us, might not think like us, might not have the same beliefs as us, but they're human beings sharing an experience on this third rock from the sun. And I think we owe it to, you know, the human species as a whole to have a little respect for that, and to maybe question the people that want to use fear and violence and plunder as a way to control the rest of us. I'm not saying we have to take up violent oppression in a violent, you know, revolution against our oppressors. I'm just saying you might want to recognize if you have oppressors and who they are and how they are oppressing you. And you might want to slowly back away from that situation, make yourself more self-reliant, and give yourself and the next generations a fighting chance of having liberty and freedom at least as much as we had when we grew up, because right now you're losing more and more first and second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth, all the way, you know, amendments, all the way up through the entire Bill of Rights. It's all being degraded. People have forgotten the needs for these specific actions that were taken as prohibitive motions. You know, thou shalt not, the Ten Commandments, formed into, you know, a belief system that went thousands of years, and then people came up with the Bill of Rights, and it's another thou shalt not. Thou shalt not deny people free speech or association of religion. Thou shalt not take away the arms that people might use to defend themselves against predation or plunder, right? Thou shalt not take away their right to vote or to have privacy or all these other things that are being taken away. So I'm not lending any credence to like a particular Ten Commandments of the Judeo-Christian belief system, because before that there was the Code of Hammurabi. There were different codes that were basically a social agreement. If we're all going to live in proximity of each other, it'd be a good thing that we don't lie to each other and we don't kill each other and we don't, you know, go stealing other people's production, right? That's just like a list of how to get along with other people in the absence of living by yourself out in the wilderness. I mean, you could do that too, but it's pretty hard. Most people can't do it, and most people prefer the company of other human beings who will follow a limited set of rules so that we can all get along and be nice. It says that I can believe in whatever I want. I can put whatever I want in my body. I can do whatever I want as long as it doesn't take away your freedom or someone else's freedom. These are all things that are acceptable, and it goes both ways. It's not a bifurcation. It's not an artificial separation. It says these people over here can make laws and wage wars and own aircraft carriers and make nuclear weapons. But these people over here, they have to throw rocks and sticks. Right? That seems like, wait, how did one set of people get all these special rights, whether they be kings and queens or premiers or presidents? How did they get the special rights to do these things, to declare war on the behalf of 300 million other people that live in this landmass? Like, all these ideas, until examined by an individual, can never be understood. And to think that you understand things that you haven't asked the questions and found the answers to is a form of self-deception. But that gets back to why we shouldn't talk about religion or politics, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting because all these concepts seem so simple. You know, I remember reading about how the settlers...
They're not complex, but you do have to think about them.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the important thing, is that it's not complex, but if you don't think about it, then it doesn't matter if it's not complex. But, you know, the settlers, how people would go live with the Indians, you know, or what they would call the Indians, the Native Americans. I feel like idiot even using the word Indians, but the Native Americans, you know, the natives that were here in North America, and how people like their lifestyle, this idea of you share things. There's not these people telling you what you can and cannot do. Everybody just has this agreement on how they live their lives. They help each other out in the community and stuff like that. And I don't know if it was some of the founding fathers that would write about these some people going off to live with the natives and then not understanding it. But, you know, it seems like really that's the way we should be living our lives, this idea that we can all – we don't need laws and rules and a ruling class to tell us what to do or what not to do. And if we all just kind of come, you know, if we all live together and we don't have these rules, we'll figure things out. And we'll of course, there's always going to be a loose cannon, some crazy person who maybe had some birth defect, who knows, and then became a lunatic or whatever. But a lot of times it's also because of, you know, the society that we've built. You know, a lot of times you see somebody who is a child molester and he was molested. You see somebody who is a drug addict and he grew up around drug addicts. So, you know, in a lot of these things, why did these things happen? Well, what's the root cause of why they became these people or why they had these issues? And sometimes it's because of a lack of happiness. It goes back to what we talked about, the lack of happiness in society. We have restrictions on what people can and cannot do. We've created a lifestyle, which is, I mean, pretty sad, this idea that, you know, you cross your fingers that you can live till retirement. And then after, you know, so your whole life, you invest everything, all blood, sweat and tears into some company so they can succeed and make money. And then you retire and you hope that you have some health left and to start enjoying life then. And that's when you get to enjoy life, after you retire, you know. And I remember Chris Christie in one of the presidential debates talking about how it's not a new idea and it's not only his idea, but I remember him talking about the idea of raising the retirement age because people are living longer. And it's just like, that's fucking ridiculous. This idea that we should just keep raising the retirement age so people can just keep investing more and more of their lives into just working is just crazy. You know, we don't have to live like this. This doesn't have to be the way society is built and the way we live our lives. So I think those are all really important things. I think the other really important thing is the fact that, like you said, the whole fake news thing, it's like, well, how about people just look things up instead of having restrictions or having somebody decide what is real or what isn't or what's false or what's fact? How about people just look things up? You know, we have all the information at our fingertips with the internet, and obviously not everything is true or accurate, but we, you know, if we can teach people how to think, we can teach people how to look things up and look at information and decide for themselves what seems to be reasonable or logical and what doesn't. And so, yeah, I think all those things are really important. And obviously nuclear war is a real thing we have to think about. And and like you said, I think you know, the next big event, you know, next Russian missile crisis like event is going to be probably motivated by emotions and people being afraid or whatnot. But I mean, what about the idea of just doing like what Texas does? Everybody has a gun, so nobody shoots themselves. What if we give everybody weapons of mass destruction, and then maybe mutual destruction? Nobody will kill themselves because we're like, oh, and then we'll all die if we start this war. I wonder if that's an option, but you know, probably going the other way would be much safer and smarter, just trying to remove them all from the world. But I think we broke the record for the longest podcast I've ever done.
I got one more response to go. you had brought up that point about the like, oh, you know, evil might exist if somebody, you know, is born with a physical abnormality, and then in that case, you know, that might spawn some evil in the world. But it's like, even if you make that argument, let's say Hitler was born with a physical abnormality to his brain that led him to be evil. So let's say you make that case. If that's your case, great. Who paid for him to come to power? Well, how did they come to be evil? right? What about all the people that followed the orders and set aside their conscience? They said, I know this is wrong to do another to another human being, but my authority told me to do that, right? So now you're getting into Amtssprache. This is Eichmann's response at the Nuremberg trials. It's like, how did you get all these people to do it? Oh, we just used this really official bureaucrat type of language that took away people's notions of thinking about free will, made them think that they had to obey these authorities. And this was the whole point of the Milgram experiment, leading into the Stanford prison experiment, to see how people will subjugate themselves to authorities, whether real or imagined, right? And that wasn't used to free people. It was used by the establishment. They're like, how do we make more malleable slaves? And how do we keep people in the dark more, right? So what you're pointing to overall, in a very general sense, is the need for intellectual self-defense against threats. And what is the major threat to people? Well, if the major cause of death of individuals in the past 100 years is democide, death by the government or death by the state, then maybe you would want intellectual self-defense to protect you from these evil powers that get out of control when wielded by the state. Oh, wait a minute. You notice that the state controls your education such that you don't have intellectual self-defense. And instead of encouraging you to learn how to use critical thinking on the internet, they're saying, let us censor the internet for you, because they know, the state knows, the people who participate in that Amtssprache system where they say, oh, I don't need to worry about it because an authority is telling me what to do and I'll just reside my consciousness. That system, in order to preserve itself and exist through the corporate statehood, corporate personage, this whole merger of corporations and our government, knows that it can't give individuals the abilities to think critically, to pursue or attain intellectual self-defense, which is just as relevant and realistically needed as physical self-defense. So you need to protect yourselves from bears and wolves and poisonous snakes and spiders and stuff, or venomous snakes and spiders and such things. But you also need to protect yourself from people who would make you a slave to plunder your production. That's the intellectual self-defense, and that's exactly why the state doesn't want to facilitate that. They'd rather control it artificially and limit and censor and make things prohibited to go out and publish or to peruse your own news out there to make decisions for yourself. This is as much a problem today with cultural Marxism and political correctness as it was back in the day when Galileo had some different ideas from the state, or when Martin Luther had some different ideas from the state, or when this character named Jesus Christ had some different ideas than what the money changers or the state were purveying back then. So all I'm saying is, I didn't live at those times, so I don't know if Martin Luther really existed. I don't know if Jesus Christ really existed, but I do know that these phenomenons I just described go on today. So you can be pretty sure that somebody called attention to them in the past and made a big deal about it, because it is irrational to have all of our lives, when we are the many, to be subjugated by the very, very few. And when you talk about the 1%, you're really talking about the 0.0001% of the people on this planet who have plundered most of the wealth of everyone else. Now, I'm not saying we should do any violence or, you know, go try to redistribute all that wealth. Maybe we just want to say, oh, that happened, and let's not let it continue happening, and let's kind of try to keep that under control so it doesn't get worse. You know, I'm not saying we should do anything drastic. I'm just saying that by actually noticing that that's gone on in the past, maybe not let it get worse. Maybe not let freedom and individual liberty go extinct in our lifetimes. Maybe do something to preserve that into the future. Because I think that, you know, if being human and living as a human being on this planet has meaning, it has meaning when we do so as free individuals, when we do so in a voluntary capacity, when we do so with empathy and critical thinking, not only to preserve ourselves and our own interests, but to make sure that other people have freedom and liberty as well, because we know that's better. That's like the best thing for ourselves and other people. And so that's not subjugating to the collective. It's saying that you can only have the collective as a composition of individuals, and that collective can only be free if the individuals who make up that collective are voluntarily associated, and they have their rights and responsibilities of self-reliance and self-confidence already in place or in progress. And if not, what you're going to have is a human species that is hollowed out, that is soulless, that is subjugated to a trivial, minuscule authority that is on the intellectual and moral low ground. And the way you know that is because they have to deceive us about their tactics of controlling us. And that we have the intellectual and moral high ground because we can be very open and say, this is what's going on. We're willing to deal with that and to make improvements to it. but we can't make improvements to a system that we assume is run by something else. Like, you can't improve the system by which Santa Claus delivers all these gifts if you don't actually recognize its parents out there who love their children that like to see the look of surprise on their faces. You know what I'm saying? You can't offer Santa a better, faster reindeer because that doesn't exist. You have to deal with the reality, which is parents love to see their children in wonder and learning and giving them things that bring them joy, because life as a responsible adult is a lot of hard work. And so to make life worth living, I think we need to tell ourselves the truth. In order to do that, we need to find out how to find truth for ourselves. We need to learn how to validate information when passed to us from other people who might have good intentions and might believe they're telling you the truth, but maybe they didn't have the time or the inclination to do all the thinking they needed to do to pass that on in a valid way. So it's not, you know, being critical or being skeptical because people are bad. It's just because life is a complex, interconnected type of phenomenon that nobody's completely figured out yet or been able to communicate to everyone else. So you have to take, some grain of salt with everything and do, you know, trust but verify. You know, I want to believe what you're saying, but I'm also going to check it out because that leads me to learning a little bit more than you just told me, which is good because then maybe we can have a conversation about that next time, you know? And that life is not a static, already decided determination, but it's kinetic and it's fluid. And you can continue to learn, and you either learn more about the reasons why you're doing things or you learn more about the reasons why you could do things differently. But as long as you're keeping in motion and with the intention of gaining knowledge and dismissing arbitrary, fallacious types of ideas, I think you're growing in the right direction.
This is why I love doing this podcast. I always learn something. It's just, it's awesome. I mean, this is one of my favorite things about being able to do this podcast is just the fact that I get to have these conversations. And as I'm having these conversations and as I'm listening to my guests talk, the motor in my brain is just going and going. And it's just, I mean, I'm just consuming everything and just taking me into so many different directions. It's awesome. Really, you're a American gem, Rich. I mean, it's amazing hearing you talk. I mean, you just have such well thought out ideas and opinions and perspectives, and it's so interesting. And it's really a pleasure to talk to you and have this conversation. It's like I said, I almost feel like I have to re-listen to this episode and be able to consume everything. But I mean, that's the beautiful thing about recording this is that I can all have the ability to do.
I feel it's complimentary because, you know, if you liked hearing anything I had to say, you can also like the fact that you provided a time and place and space for me to say it and for it to be memorialized for other people to actually hear it. It's like, if you like what I said on stage, you got to appreciate the people who built the stage and built the venue and got you to come and check out, you know, what this guy had to say, you know? I'm still thinking about how you said Perloff lives in Boston and how I can get an in-person filmed interview with him now and like what books I've read of his and like where I would want to pick up and start making those questions. But I also had to set that aside because my priority was just to have, you know, a kinetic kind of stream of consciousness conversation with you, try to listen to your points, see where you're going and seeing what you're trying to get to the audience, and then go back and meet you and say, okay, you made this point. I, you know, have this to offer about it, and just try to make it a rich texture, fabric of knowledge. And if it's not knowledge yet, then maybe it's just information that you seek to validate in your own time. Either way, I'm not offended. I like people who learn, and I'm kind of turned off by people who already assume that they have the answer before inspecting the data.
Yeah.
So it was an enriching experience for me too. That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate that.
I feel like
that.
I've grown, and I always look at, you know, these types of conversations as a point in the day where I don't have to work. Because up until, you know, we had the conversation, I'm like trying to edit, I'm trying to get things done, doing all this stuff. But then it's like, oh, I get to talk to Ricky. I get to, you know, sit back, relax, and, you know, have a cup of coffee and just let it flow. Let life flow.
Yeah, that's kind of my goal. I think that there's something to doing these long type of conversations because...
Plus, you had no agenda. That's the other difference. It wasn't like predetermined, come here, talk about this thing right here. You know, that's the same thing as going to a bar to pick up people or going to a bar, a sports bar to watch a game. You offer more of the public house type of podcast where there's no agenda. It's open discussion. The discussion is probably going to trend around the concept of freedom, intellectual or physical in some capacity, because these are the things that we as human beings kind of take interest in for the most part.
The, pub- the Public House Podcast. I think you just created a name for a podcast. Somebody's going to take that. That's a great name for a podcast, the Public House Podcast. You're right. I mean, it's funny because I had Anthony Schaefer on not too long ago, and we didn't talk about his book because we went on a
rant. Operation Darkheart.
Yeah, exactly. And we just went off on a thousand different things. I had Tom Secker on, and we were supposed to talk about CIA and their influence in Hollywood and movies, and we didn't talk about that at all. And I'm just waiting for my listeners
to
get
angry. Tells you next time you talk to Tom, now you got all these other interesting things you still want to talk about, and you can keep doing that until you actually get to those topics. I think Tom's work is fascinating, and I kind of envy you being in a position where you're just like, I'm just going to create this forum and invite cool people, and whatever gets talked about, and I'm not going to try to artificially structure that. I mean, I think there's a calling for both. I like the idea of organization and actually getting to certain points that need to be communicated to people, but there's also a place for, hey, what would happen if you just put these two people on Skype right now?
Yeah, you know? I think, yeah. And the thing is, too,
where are
they
at today? What are they thinking about?
I remember when I had Aaron Franz on, who what the hell was this film called? The one about transhumanism and Age of Transition? Is that it? Maybe it's
a
documentary.
I saw that movie. I just don't remember if that was the person who made that movie.
Yeah, it was Aaron. I don't know how to pronounce Franz. But he was on my podcast, and he was talking about how one thing he liked about the show was how I would have somebody on like yourself, you know. And then the next show I'd have like the Amazing Jonathan on, or I'd have the singer of Fear Factory, you know, a metal band I like, or, you know, I hope that people who are into one thing will be exposed to another thing that they might not.
East Coast Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah, it is. Well, he was a huge influence of mine, mostly because it was probably the only podcast that I could probably recreate because I didn't find myself intelligent enough to do something like you do, you know. Everybody finds that niche that they're good at. I feel like I've always been pretty good of just having casual conversations. If that is a talent, then that's a talent that I might have. So
that's definitely a talent. Rogan's got a talent for that. I mean, because, you know, I was always thinking, it's like, oh, man, he's having all these great 3-hour conversations with people, but if it were me, I'd be like trying to read up on, I would be like doing the nth amount of research, trying to make sure I was not leaving anything under the table or no stone unturned. But there's also a point to the casual angle of it, because then you might be getting things that you never even thought of planning to have on the list to talk about anyway. And there's a need, and it's like they're complementary. That's what I'm saying. It's not competing at all. It's just adding value to the whole conversation. When I do my show in my studio downstairs in the basement, it's one of the puns behind the deep end. It's also not the shallow end of the pool. This is for people who actually want to get their knowledge on. But, we talk about things in a casual way, but we do have, like, I like to talk about what are the things that have happened in our culture that are relevant and substantial since the last episode. And it's juxtaposing current events to what we know about the history or what we need to learn or what, you know, it's all blind spot for all of us. And now we're, you know, showing the audience how we go about learning for ourselves. So, it does have a little structure to it, but there's also a big question mark. Anytime I sit down there, who's going to say what and how's it going to go and where are we going to end up? Who knows? You know, and I think that's part of the excitement that the audience gets out of it for those who get to see it. And what I want to say is, now that I've got most of my equipment replaced from, I guess the part I didn't talk about is when we went to D.C. in October, we also got robbed at the end of that trip. So I've had to spend the last couple months kind of replacing that equipment. But since I got the studio all up and running again, whenever the weather's good, I know we're probably going to have snow here in the next couple of days, but I'll be filming episodes in the coming weeks and coming months. And whenever it's convenient, you can come down, bring your wife down, however you want to do it. You can bring your kids too, as far as I'm concerned. We can make a day of it, and we'll have the wives play with the kids upstairs, and we'll do some work downstairs, and then we can all get a meal together and share a little food. But I think you're only like 45 minutes or an hour away, and like you said, it's always better to be in studio. And then, we can have an interesting guest on the Skype, but we share that dynamic of being local and non-local at the same time.
Yeah.
There's a quantum physics joke there, but I'm not going to try.
Yeah, it's not far at all. We actually go to Hartford once in a while to go out to eat and stuff like that. And, I mean, obviously with the kids, we don't get out as nearly as much as we'd like to, but it is necessary every once in a while to still, you know, not invest all your love and attention and time just in the child, but in the relationship also. So that's something that you have to stay just conscious of and keep giving effort and attention to. But yeah, it's not that far at all. Hartford's, you know, hop on, you know, 291 and to the 91 and
yeah, I'm like 5 minutes from 91.
Yeah, not far at all. So yeah, you know, I used to go down to the Manchester Funny Bone all the time and at the Buckland Hill Mall and we used to go out and then go out in Hartford and go out to eat, you know, and stuff like that. So it's a fun city, and Connecticut being I'm right over the border. I'm not that far from Enfield and right over the border. So it's, you know, it's convenient. It's nice. And, you know, honestly, Springfield, I hate to say it about my, my closest city, but it's a dying city. And I think they're building a casino that they're working on as we speak. And
they're building casinos everywhere. They're building them here in East Hartford too. And it's like, oh, what's it going to, I just keep picturing that Back to the Future, the second movie where Biff took control. And it's like, it's like Pottersville, you know, from It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, yeah.
Bedford Falls is now Pottersville. Biff is in control. I'm mixing two cinematic features, but they're both dystopic at those particular points in the story. Like it's like Idiocracy. It's like, oh, you know, we've gotten away from the meaningful things of life, and we're just stuck around these superficial trivialities. You know, casinos, yeah. And, you know, all sorts of places to get liquored up and to not have any self-responsibility so you can be controlled by authority. Those are common themes of those two films at certain points in their stories. But, the Hartford Funny Bone, it's technically in Manchester, but I think they call it Hartford
Funny Bone. Yeah.
And a lot of people come through there, and I've often thought, like, I should just talk to some of these comedians, booking agents, and, you know, they're here for a weekend. We come out, have them come over and do a little podcast. I've interviewed some people like at the venue. Like I went to see Dick Gregory and then I interviewed him for like a half hour afterwards. But I've been meaning to get that on the schedule, and that'd be actually something worth driving down for. It's like if we can get Bert Kreischer the next time he comes through.
Yeah. I think I've seen him like 2-3 times at the Funny Bone. I saw Amy Schumer there before she blew up. I saw Greg Giraldo before he passed away. I saw him there twice, and one time I was lucky enough to hang out with him a little bit after the show. You know, they do the shaking hands and stuff like that, and we bullshitted for a while, and super nice guy. He was one of my favorites. And then, Tom Segura, I saw him there like way back in the day, but before, you know, he's now doing a lot of big gigs too. And, I've seen Bert there. I've seen, a lot of cool people, and Ian Baggs, who
I just think it would improve their comedy if they had a little bit wider palette of colors representing like knowledge that's actually going on, that's relevant to people, that people want to know about. And it's like, hey, how can you make this funny? Like, I'll tell you the history if you figure out a way to make it funny and then get it on people's radar, because people love to hear about such, like, just think about like the phenomenon of Bill Hicks or George Carlin or Richard Pryor. Like these guys are Lenny Bruce. These guys were all talking about aspects of life that were kind of taboo, but it's those taboo subjects that are really hiding the main understanding of what's going on, you know? And at a certain point in Carlin's career, like he could just tell you the truth. He wouldn't even have to make it funny, really. He'd be like, you know, it's a big club and you're not in it. You've got owners. Like he was basically just lecturing us on how dumb we are. And we're like, oh, this guy's so great. He's so funny. Why is it funny? Because it's ironic that we don't just know this every day, that we don't recognize what he's saying. The same thing with Bill Hicks. You know, it's just a ride. Like, why are we letting ourselves get all bought and get it, you know, bought into these ideas, these illusions, and getting anxious and raising our stress level, when really life can be a beautiful, amazing thing, but all too often that is just like squashed out of any part of our perception because of these other things. And it's like, that's another thing that I thought was ironic. Like, you know, psychedelics don't get on your radar to a certain point in life when you bump into them. It's like, wait, why shouldn't this be on everyone's menu the whole time? Like, you might not want to select it until you're a certain age. You know, get some maturity and some self-responsibility and critical thinking skills. But still, it should be like it's on the menu so you can work up to that. Like it's like an advanced life using level. Like, you know, you're an advanced user in life if you can get to those levels and operate. Well, it's on the menu. And to me, like growing up in Western Pennsylvania, like I said, like alcohol and cannabis were barely on the menu because I came from a town that was like a dry town. It didn't have any establishments in it, right?
What? How dare it?
So I come from Beaver, Pennsylvania, and it's a town within the city limits, doesn't serve any alcohol, and I don't think it sells any alcohol because I think the one beer distributor that's kind of in the vicinity technically is outside of some sort of line, or maybe there's a loophole, but there's no bars in it. So as a kid, when my friends were going out to bars, they'd actually have to leave the town, go across the river or go down the river, because there's a lot of rivers there, and get out of town or bring it back into like the county seat. So, you know, I'm not saying there wasn't any corruption or any untowardness going on. I'm just saying there's a lot less of it on your radar when it's not being made the single focal point, like having casinos in your town. When it's the point of the whole casino is to like get you drunk and take your money, you know?
Yeah, that's it's so interesting. I'll tell you one thing that's kind of sad is how we don't have like a second coming of a George Carlin or a Bill Hicks. But some people actually complain about. I've had conversations with people that are really into comedy, and they're like, you know what? I love Hicks. I love Carlin, but they did. It was almost like it was borderline almost not comedy, like you said. It was almost just lecturing. And so it's like it's hard to put them up there with the best comedians because were they actually telling jokes? Were they actually saying, you know, attempting to say something funny? But maybe that, you know, a lot of times, like you said, that's what makes it funny. The fact that it's so obvious or something that's so obvious, but yet we're ignoring or we don't actually pay attention to. And the truth behind it is what makes it funny, you know. But I mean,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Some,
I mean, it's like the advanced curriculum. Like from my personal experience, here's like a path of discovery that's like off the map. You just happen to be out there exploring and you find Joe Rogan's website, and on the website, here's Doug Stanhope, here's Bill Hicks, here's you know, Kevin Booth making videos and recording Bill Hicks doing his thing and having an online store. And in that online store is a t-shirt that has like the chemical molecular visual of psilocybin. And it's like squeegee open your third eye. Right. And then yeah. You're like, so you're being exposed to psychedelics, to comedy, to mind expanding, consciousness raising words being used in the human vernacular, as well as, substances that grow copiously across the planet if they weren't prohibited. And here's all the things that can save humanity kind of, right? Because you have to have a good sense of humor because there's a lot of, you know, grief and sadness and pain and torment going on in the world unnecessarily. So you got to have a sense of humor in order to keep dealing with it, to try to improve that situation and not just give up. But you also have to, you know, the comedy aspect is taking something that you think you're familiar with and showing it to you at this different angle that it tickles your funny bone, right? So there's like all these things, but that wasn't going to be shown to me through public school. It wasn't shown to me by mainstream mass media. It wasn't shown to me like in a major Hollywood film. It wasn't shown to me like, you know, by the cool kids in school or whatever. It's like these are things that you're just out there exploring that which exists, and you bump into things that you're like, oh, that's interesting. And then you keep following that interest. And so you could be led around in all sorts of different directions. Fortunately for me, by the time I had, you know, bumped into comedians talking about psychedelics and here's some t-shirts that have psychedelic references on them, it's like I'd already had those experiences in college. So it wasn't new to me. What was new to me was not the experience, but the knowledge that other people had these experiences too. And I think that was some of the bravest stuff that Bill Hicks did, was he worked his personal psychedelic experiences into his comedy. He told you some of those stories that make you scratch your head and you're like, wow, really? Is that possible? Well, if you've never had those experiences, you'd have those questions. And if you've already had those experiences, all of a sudden you're laughing your balls off. You know,
yeah.
You're like, holy shit, this guy gets it, you know? And that's why, you know, one of his most memorable pieces is, you know, It's Just a Ride.
Yeah, that. And the other one is, if you work in marketing, kill yourself.
It was barely
a joke. It was more like he was.
No,
just,
I mean, sometimes it's just being like, if you can see these things, you're frustrated by it. So what he was doing was releasing his frustration in a way that made people who were unfamiliar with that frustration laugh, and made other people who are familiar with that frustration laugh even harder.
Yeah, it was funny because he's like, no, I'm serious. Kill yourself. You know, it was just it was funny because it was, you know, it's kind of like I said, it's kind of sad. Joe Rogan's last, and you used the word triggered already in this podcast, but his latest stand up special on Netflix called Triggered. He seems like he has hints of talking about, you know, he seems like he has the potential because he's so open minded and he's very well thought out and stuff like that. You know, he could be somebody like that, you know, somebody who really focuses on how dumb.
In some ways, I think he's already surpassed Bill Hicks insofar as he's not only learned how to make these observations funny and palatable and marketable, which are things that Bill Hicks did, but he also figured out how to have his own show, how to be independent, how to be able to say, I'm not going to censor my jokes. I have my own platform and my own show. And Bill Hicks, I think, struggled with that between trying to have the foot in the corporate media, Tonight Show, you know, David Letterman type of comedy where you can be popularized that way versus staying true to what he was actually thinking about and thinking was funny. So I think, you know, Rogan has broken some new ground, which wasn't broken by Pryor or, Bill Hicks or Lenny Bruce or any of the other great comedians or Carlin. Carlin didn't have his own, you know, platform that he could reach 60 million people every couple days. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
Lee Camp, who he loves Lenny Bruce. I remember when I had him on the show, he talked about how he was his biggest influence. But Lee Camp is kind of a political type of talks about current events, stand-up comedian. I just don't think he focuses on touring and writing, an hour special type thing as much because he has his show and he's always doing interviews and stuff like that. But
He travels. He does shows in different cities on a weekend because when we were down in D.C., we were interviewing John F. O'Donnell, who's also on the RT show, and Lee was out of town that weekend doing gigs. I think what he's doing is, you know, it's tough to build up an hour of content when you're being presented with so much content all the time. It's like, what's the favorite? And sometimes he says, you know, he takes a perspective on something, and I'm thinking, dude, like, if you only would check out these other sources, there's a way to, like, get a lot closer to the truth, you know? Instead of just having, like, your toe on the moving vehicle, you could actually jump on and hang on to it and, like, get that ride. He's a human being. He's got a full-up schedule. He's very successful already. If he gets, like, 8 out of 10 comedic positions, like, right on with the evidence and 2 of them he should have done more research, then that's still pretty good, right? It's better than I'm doing. I can't even make it funny. I might get 10 out of 10 right. Like, this is the actual evidence that exists. And if you show me something different, then I'll amend my response. But it's like, I hate to see good evidence left on the table and not integrated into the passing on of the communication. But at the same time, I'm not being tasked with making all that stuff funny. And sometimes the funnier thing is leaving that piece out, you know?
That's true too. Yeah. That's
right. And so, like, I just try to appreciate human beings for who they are and who they can be and not wish them to be the way I would want them to be or whatever, because that's a lot less interesting. And it causes a lot more problems if you don't do that, you know?
Well, one thing, interviewing so many people, like I have, I mean, not that many, but I mean, I think this is episode.
No, you got a good palate going.
Yeah. It's, you realize how many people have issues with one another. You know, I've had, you know,
I got no use for all that drama. I don't envy the position where you have to actually try to discern, oh, you know, I had Dennis McKenna on and that's going to cause trouble with this other guest or whatever because they don't like each other. I'm like, I have no time for the BS drama when there are much bigger forces going on to that, you know, are adversely affecting freedom.
And the way I look is that we're all on the same team because even if we don't all agree on how to get there, we're all looking to do the same thing. And that's, you know, trying to obviously expose the corruption and, like you said, the lack of freedoms that we have and all that stuff. And those, you know, and expose the real enemies, you know, and it's not one another. It's like, okay, so maybe Ryan Dawson and somebody else might not agree on what happened on September 11th, but does that have to, you know, on what hit the Pentagon or whatever the hell it may be? But, you know, if somebody's, and I always say this, you know, and I think I remember saying this to Ryan, I'm like, but if somebody's heart is in the right place, you know, if, you know, I know he bashes the guys from Loose Change. You know, I've had Jason Burmes on. He was one of my first guests I've ever had on my show.
With Dylan Avery. See, that's the whole thing. I don't get why people like that have beefs with each other. Because at the end of the day, aren't you both against the people trying to take away individual liberty and freedom?
Exactly.
Right? And can't we just all agree on more freedom, less slavery? Like, I don't want so much freedom that I have to live out in the wilderness by myself and have no human contact. Because that's pretty much all the freedom you can have. I'm willing to give up just a little bit to get along with other people because I like my family and my friends and I love my son and I want these human interactions. So I'm willing to give up just a little bit of all that stuff. But when it comes to the point where you got to, you know, deliver up almost all your freedom and individual liberty to just subsist as a slave, I think that might be a point for intellectual resistance on those ideas. You know, maybe we got some better ideas we can implement here, you know, but
And if somebody's heart's in the right place, if somebody, so like you said, you even referred to Lee Camp, how sometimes maybe his information might not be 100% correct. And that's, I mean, I get shit wrong all the time.
I'm
probably
me too, dude. That's what I'm saying. None of us is perfect. I think Lee Camp's a brilliant, he's a brilliant intellectual, and he's a brilliant comedian. And,
but if
and
if he's trying to
enjoy his work, absolutely.
Yeah, and if he's trying,
I enjoy Ryan Dawson's work. I enjoy Loose Chain, like, you know, Dylan and Jason and Corey's work. I enjoy, I mean, there's people that don't even like me. There's people that don't like me. I enjoy their work nonetheless.
They don't exist. People, like, now you're making things up, Rich. But if somebody doesn't like you, give me a list. That I'm never inviting them on this show. And but yeah, it's true. It's like if someone. if people's hearts are in the right place, and people, you know, if their goal is to do the same thing as you, and that's expose whatever, then, and like you said, more freedom, less slavery, then, you know, maybe we might disagree on some facts, we might, but to dislike somebody or bash somebody's work, I mean, Loose Change, I just saw the video that was just posted on, I believe it was posted on your YouTube channel with Dylan and Jesse Ventura talking, and you know, he talked, was that on your, that was on your YouTube channel?
Yeah, we had gone into Brooklyn on the weekend of 9/11 this past year. So, September 10th, I think that was, we were in Brooklyn, as part of a film crew that interviewed, Governor Ventura, and, the guy who was directing it said, cut, everyone shut off their sound and cameras, except me, cause I've been in these situations before. And that's when all the interesting stuff happens. Of course, Dylan's like, hey, Governor Ventura. And they had that whole interaction, and I was like, I know I'm the only one that has a camera running right now, so I cut that and put it up on the YouTube page just for historical purposes.
Yeah,
and people in the future will be interested to be like, oh, here's this dude who made this movie, here's this guy who watched this movie, see how both their lives changed because of it.
Absolutely.
You know,
and that's so important, and that's the thing. So to bash a piece of work that probably, I mean, made a lot of people go down this rabbit hole of questioning everything they know, that alone makes it worth existing. So this idea of, like, you know, bashing them and, oh, and then, you know, Ryan was trying to tell me that
I mean, I know Ryan's perspectives, and I saw the multiple versions of Loose Change that were made, because they didn't just make a movie and say, this is right and you guys are all wrong. They said, oh, we can improve it. We can use better. This data is stronger than this data. We're going to show this. We're going to take this other part out because it's kind of speculation. We don't want to keep passing that on if it's kind of weak data, you know? And Ryan has a ton of great points. But these points can also, you know, they're also, and it's not just one or the other, you know?
Exactly. And I think anytime somebody says that I have truth with a capital T and everybody else is wrong, it rubs me the wrong way. And I think the other thing that kind of rubs me the wrong way is anytime you assume you know somebody's intentions, you know, this idea that, oh, they knew they were wrong and that's why they, you know, and they put that wrong information in there anyway. Like, you don't know that. You're assuming that. You're assuming, and you know, and that's your opinion. But
when I always question people's motives when they'd rather debunk or defame or destroy someone else's work rather than actually talk to them and discover what maybe how these seemingly irreconcilable, you know, positions could actually coexist without being untrue or deceptive or evil or any of these other things. So it's, again, it's like, are you willing to put in the energy to actually find out, or are you just, you know, going to say that person's a shill because they don't believe that XYZ group did it all on their own, when maybe the picture is a little bit more nuanced. And my favorite metaphor to draw is a cinematic example that comes from a book. So you can have either if you want to check it out, but it's Murder on the Orient Express. And instead of looking for the single person who did the event, maybe you figure out everyone on the train, spoiler alert, had a motive and the means and the intent and the capability and actually participated in a small part of it. And then you could see, like, the whole story. Like, so that's what I don't get. It's like, These things, it's not so new to humanity that no one's ever figured these things out before. It's like, there are examples of, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it sure does rhyme, as Mark Twain said. It's like, there are things we could draw from the past, but we're kind of closing ourselves off from that when we play fantasy football or we do all these other things that are kind of, like I said at the beginning of the conversation, disposable media that aren't useful in learning these life lessons or sharpening our perspectives and reviewing how to improve on those life lessons that we were trying to learn and always have to learn a little bit differently each time that history rhymes. But there are some general premises of how things work and how things can be brought about where people can actually work together voluntarily and not violate other people's volition or plunder their production or take their freedom. But I think that just gets lost in the background when you have, you know, the internet available and everything's available and you can watch cats playing with yarn or, you know, puppies splashing in a puddle or these other people beating these other people up or these other people bombing these other people. It's like whatever level of distraction you want, the internet basically makes it available, which I think reinforces the need to have priorities based around what you need to survive in reality, to meet your needs, and then to distinguish your needs from your wants, and then how to prioritize gaining those wants. You might want the comprehensive understanding of how everything in the world works, but you also have to understand and prioritize that doesn't all happen in one day. It doesn't all happen from listening to one conversation or having one psychedelic experience, but it's a long chain of events that are always taken with integrity, with the right type of intention where you're trying to learn to outgrow the status quo for purposes of preserving your own freedom and enabling others to have freedom likewise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I need to talk to Eddie Bravo and have us on the Joe Rogan podcast, because similar to yourself, I've always wondered if I could do 3 hours, and I just three and a half hours just flew by. That was pretty awesome. And Rich,
well, I'm glad you didn't find it was like way too long or anything. You know,
I did three hours with John B. Wells.
A couple months ago, and I thought the same thing. Oh, he's going to do a 3-hour conversation, no breaks, no commercials. And, you know, he said, okay, it's been 3 hours. And I was like, oh, really, already? I was like, yeah. You know, when we're talking about freedom, there's so much to it. We could talk all day, but you're right. That's probably plenty for this episode. And we've already elongated some people's attention spans and given other people a whole list of things that they written down as notes to check out.
Well, between me and you, because my wife doesn't listen to my show, she is rushing me a little bit, so but that's a nice thing about your wife not listening to the show that you create, because you can talk about her. But it's one of those things where you know, 3 hours, if the conversation's flowing, and the beautiful thing about having these casual conversations, it's why when you're talking to somebody, time does fly. You know, it's because you're really engaged in the conversation and you're not really paying attention to time. So but yeah, thanks so much, Rich. I really appreciate it. Please give me those days. I would be honored to be invited to give anything I can contribute to the conversations that you have at your studio. And I would love to hang out, and I'll definitely bring you some cigars. And I don't know what you drink, but I could bring a bottle of a couple of things that I love to drink. So
yeah, share your favorites. What we'll do is, not to say we have no agenda at all, but when you come down to do a deep end, I want to talk about doing this public house podcast, and we'll have a couple other podcasters like Brett Vinat and a couple other idea people like Kevin Cole. And it's like, we can schedule on a regular basis, and whoever can make it, just like going to the pub, shows up, has a conversation. Whoever can't make it for other scheduling, you know, conflicts, we can get people like Corbett, James Evan Pilato. You know, there's a whole bunch of all-stars. We can bring together this super group. And it's not unlike what I've seen some comedians do, where they sit on the panel and they're all funny. And yeah, I think we all have the right spirit of, it's not about us, but when we get together and talk about things, it seems to be a little bit interesting, more interesting than what they have on mainstream media, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that people would love to see that, especially, you know, these are all people, yourself, James Corbett, I mean, all these people, Brett, I mean, these are all people that are really interesting and people love. And I think people really like the sharing of ideas and the casual conversations, and seeing where the conversation leads. I think that's that's always the fun part, is you never, like you said before, like you never know where these conversations are going to lead. And if it was all written out and we had this format, we might never hit these topics.
If we had to break every 9 minutes and 50 seconds for station identification and a few commands,
yeah,
it would really.
That's why I don't do ads. I don't do any
I
of that
don't either.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. It's a whole different dynamic than the whole other thing that's been going on for, 100 years during the time that we all got, hornswoggled. So I'm hoping that what we're doing is more in tune with the solution and getting away from the problems of breaking people's attention every couple minutes. But another idea for a podcast I had was, let's just list all the great ideas that we have that we don't have the means and resources and money to actually make happen, so that maybe it inspires people on the other end of this microphone who do have those resources or those means or experience or, you know, funds to make it happen, because these are all different ingredients that we see that would be, inspiring or sparking truth and freedom and liberty, all the things that we see are being eroded and degraded in our society. and we can't do it all ourselves. And I always like to just, you know, put the challenge out to the audience. It's like, if you think that's a good idea, you know, XYZ project, but that's a whole nother podcast idea that at some point, maybe we'll kick off. But I think we should do the Public House podcast prior to that because it can lead into the spinoffs such as I just described.
Yeah, that is a great, and then it just flows. It's catchy. That's a great name for a podcast. That's the beautiful thing about having these conversations. Things will just pop up like that, you know.
We can get some cool pubware for it too.
and if you guys wanna have a drink during it, I mean, I'm not sure. I've done a couple of shows where I've gotten a little tipsy on them, and surprisingly, people find them pretty funny and amusing. So it's
we've had some. I don't have a rule for the deep end. So if it's like we want to chill out and like you could hang out with your guy friends and have some beers, or you could do that as a podcast and maybe make something more of it, right? So I don't have it as a rule that we have to drink for the show, but like last episode, there's one of our subscribers. He lives in Edmonton, Alberta. He's a brewmeister. He has a brewery called Blind Man Brewing. He FedExed us some yeast samples, about a dozen of them, a variety of which he makes. So we had all these different cans and bottles, and we consumed some. We imbibed during the show. Now, it didn't get to the point where I couldn't, you know, construct a sentence or I couldn't maintain coherent thoughts. It didn't get, like, tipsy or drunk or out of control. But I think it's a respectful thing that, you know, you have to respect the individuals who are of the age where they can maintain their self-responsibility and still cogently communicate, have the right, if they want to imbibe some activated yeast in some sort of brew, that they can do that. And it's not a rule, and it's not a rule against it either way. The cigar smoking, though, has a lingering effect downstairs, and I think I'd have to move the studio before we can combine those two elements. Maybe there's occasions for that, too. Maybe I'll do some episodes where we're outside, especially when the weather gets nicer.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds like a blast. I'd love to be a part of that. And I've heard quite a few podcasts with Rogan and other comedians where they drink during the show. And I think they're awesome. I think they're fun. And I think that it's awesome to see a silly side of people. And,
it keeps it balanced.
It does.
It's not so sterile and like scripted where it's like painful to participate in. It's like you can relax and have a good time, too, while you actually do something productive, more productive than what most other people do in those circumstances.
Absolutely. And that's a nice thing about being self-employed, you know, doing things your own way and having.
Like, for instance, today I had coffee and a glass of iced tea. So maybe I'm caffeinated, but I really don't see caffeine having too much of an effect on me, whether I have it or not.
Yeah. Awesome. This is, what is it, 340. We just killed the record. I'm going to send you a trophy when I go down there.
Yeah, you're working. You're like 1 minute away from
divorce.
from being 15 minutes for 4 hours. It's 3:45. Oh, actually, it's 3:45 right now.
Yeah, 3:45. Yeah, and then after I do a short intro, because I'll definitely do a short intro because nobody's going to want to listen to me talk for that long. But and then I'll definitely do a short intro and then put this together. Yeah, we'll be up there. So and then the music, the intro music, all that stuff. So yeah, it'll be awesome. Another thing, I'll go on a tangent about something else. But thanks, Richard. I really appreciate it. This is an interview I've been waiting to do for a long time. I think initially I was in contact with your wife Lisa.
You've been waiting patiently. It's been like a year and a half, dude. I'm pretty sure it was before we even knew Lucas was on his way that you were asking. And so I appreciate you being patient. I've had a lot that I got done in that time. I like to do podcasts when I feel I'm going to have time not to be like under my own, timeline for getting something done. Like right now I have to get, I'm working on a book, The Truth About the Rothschilds. And, it's something I started several years ago. Well, if you want to count collecting the research, like 10 years ago. And recently I did an Indiegogo fundraiser, which was very successful, which then puts you like on a time schedule to actually get the project done. So I found that very helpful to my productivity. And, but I wanted nonetheless not to just focus on that the whole time. And I think it's good to every now and then take some time out to reflect and relax with a colleague who has similar interests as we did here today. And, I found it, thought provoking. Even though I'm participating in it. So I hope it does likewise for the listeners.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, you're definitely right. Cause I remember when I used to write music, you get so just, I guess, stuck in that little mindset, and sometimes it's nice to kind of just start over, you know, go have a coffee, go, you know, go outside for a little bit, or go, you know, go to the, I would go to the gym or whatever, then come back and I kind of start over. I'd see things from a different perspective and I could start writing again. So sometimes taking that break from whatever you're so deep into is a good thing. But yeah, thanks, Rich. I really appreciate it. We'll definitely keep in touch. I'll send you the links to the show once it's up and live. And I'll, like I always tell people, it's open source, so you can share it, post it wherever you'd like if you want to. And thanks again. I really appreciate it. Good luck with your son and being a father. It's one of the most amazing experiences I've ever been through. I'm sure it's one of the most amazing experiences you're going through, and there's nothing like it.
Absolutely rewarding.
It is. It's the hardest thing you'll ever do and the most rewarding thing
ever do. You trained your whole life to do this part, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And the crazy part is when you get, you know, you become a parent, you realize that, like, we're all just figuring it out. You know, our parents,
at
we looked at...
Yeah, different levels, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we looked at our parents like they had it all figured out, and then you become a parent, you're like, oh, we don't have it all figured out. We're figuring it out. You know, we're just kind of making it up as we go.
Well, that ties back to that Joe Rogan joke where he's in line at the cashier one day, and he realizes there's no adults or authorities. He's like, wait a minute, you guys don't know what you're doing either?
Yeah.
I'm just part of a long chain of people that don't know what they're doing at various levels.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing
cool.
To realize, yeah, that, you know, we're all kind of just figuring it out together. Yeah, it's good.
It
it's a good
to keep it real when you have that perspective, you know.
It does absolutely.
Some people are having a good day, some people are having a not so good day. We can play a role by how we react and put our thinking between our stimulus and response.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, thanks, Rich. Keep in touch. I'll send you these links once it's up and live. I'm gonna go you know.
Yeah, go do what you gotta do. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. And to everyone listening, thank you for actually listening. And have yourself a happy new year.
Yeah, you too, man. If I don't talk to you beforehand, have a great New Year's. Have fun. I know with kids, it's kind of restrictive. We can't go out and party like we used to. But it's, you know, it's fun just being around the kids. Like you said, it's the most rewarding thing we do. And there's nothing like it. So to come home and see my son running at me, wanting my attention and stuff like that,
it makes you reprioritize. What am I need to talk to this guy on Skype for anymore? I got everything.
I'll
hang out with you, you know, in 2017. We'll make it not too long, and we'll do something in studio, and then we'll plan something outside so we can have a cigar festival.
Yeah, definitely. I'll bring some stuff down. I'm a big share when it comes down to cigars and alcohol. I love just bringing stuff that I'm into and letting people try it. So I'll definitely bring some stuff.
I need to find a local public house where we can host the public house podcast from.
That'd be pretty cool, huh? If we actually did one at a pub. That'd be pretty cool. We'll have to Google some pubs nearby and see if there's anything quiet enough. Well, if we do, yeah, I guess we'd have to pick a day where it's not too crazy. And set up a little equipment. I've recorded stuff even on my phone outside. I have a podcast I did, The Backyard Philosophy, where we're just in the backyard smoking, and I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna record this conversation on my phone, and if I can get it to sound decent, I'm gonna share it. And then that's what I end up doing. I end up recording it, and then it actually didn't come out too bad. I had a podcast recording app on my phone, and it came out good enough where I thought it was worth sharing. So
that's what makes it meaningful. It's you're creating a tool that's useful for others.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, thanks, Rich. Have a great New Year's, and we'll keep in touch and keep me updated on those dates. And I'm sure right now, in the next couple months until probably April, May, when work really picks up for me, my schedule is pretty flexible. So, whenever it is, I'm sure I could probably make it work. So keep me updated. Let me know.
Will do.
Thanks, Rich. Hey, take care.
All right. Peace.
Bye.